lum lay out, lum 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 lady lay, he um lum lay out, lum lady lay out, liddy 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 liddy, hey a hoka hey, liddy 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 liddy. I see a white horse, an angel standing, goddess standing in the lotus sky, red as a dragon's eye, but light like a feather. And way across the horizon, deep in the hills, thunder is coming, echoing valley. An elven king, gentle, his master moves in robes of wind. And the poet on your breath, sweeter than peaches, bitter as grandfather time, may slip past you in a rhythm and shadow, but is received between the lines. Liddy, 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 hey, ah, ho, ka, hey. Liddy, 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 liddy. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child.
Good afternoon and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. It's that time of the week, folks. It's 2 p.m. Well, I'll be with you. I'm Janaea, your host, and co-hosting with me this afternoon is Hope for Peace.
Cheers.
She's back.
Yay!
And we are real honored. From 2 to 3, we're going to be speaking with Annie Michon, and she is a former intelligence officer for the MI-15, and that's the United Kingdom Security Service. She resigned in 1996 to blow the whistle on the spy's incompetence and crimes with her ex-partner, David Shaler. She's an author, media pundit, journalist, campaigner, and prominent public speaker on a variety of issues. And she will be speaking with us from 2 to 3, and she's going to be presenting this weekend at Understanding Deep Politics, Revealing the Driving Forces Behind World Events and Creating Alternative Solutions. That's going to be held this weekend, starting Friday, May 14th through the 16th, Understanding Deep Politics Conference. And that's going to be the UCSC Conference and Inn Center.
Fantastic.
And we're real excited about that. And we'll be sharing a bit of more information shortly around that. Jason King, one of the sponsors of the event, will be sharing with us also. And then from 3 to 4, we'll be speaking with Barry Zwicker about 9/11 and false flags operations. And then 4 to 5, we'll be speaking with Daryl Wilson. He's a Native American elder, about the origination of thought and who really discovered America. But right now, I am so excited to have Annie here. Annie, welcome to Santa Cruz.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's such an honor to have you here, too.
It's great to be back. I came over about 18 months ago to do a couple of talks about some of these issues as well.
Wonderful.
And I had a fantastic time. It's a lovely part of the world.
Thank you. It is. It's beautiful. We're surrounded by the ocean on one side and the mountain on the other.
Yes.
But I want to get started by asking you about the intelligence industry, for lack of a better word, in the UK, the difference between the MI5 and the MA6.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you chose the right word there. It is an intelligence industry now.
And then we have private contractors.
Absolutely.
And also,
we'll
get into that, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, they are definitely a growth industry in the UK, and a lot of ex-spooks tend to wash up into those organizations. So it's a bit of a mess. In the UK we have quite a messy official intelligence infrastructure as well. We have MI5, as you mentioned, which is the organisation I worked for. And that's the sort of UK security service, it's officially called. And they used to shorten it down to UKSS until they realised that had sort of fascistic overtones from Germany in the Second World War.
Maybe it was done intentionally.
Well, they've changed it now, but for a long time. But so we have three primary organisations, MI5, and then we have MI6, which is the sort of external intelligence gathering agency. And they are the James Bond, sort of, they like to think they're the James Bonds of the intelligence world. So they operate abroad. They're a bit like the CIA, and MI6 is a bit like the FBI.
There you go.
And then we have GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters, and that is the same as the NSA. And in fact, they have those two organisations, the NSA and GCHQ, have an amazingly close relationship, so that they've managed, even before the war on terror and the erosion of all our freedoms, they managed to share all their product, all the intelligence they gathered, and could thus circumvent the oversight in each other, in their own countries, by giving each other the information from each other's countries. Is a really messy setup.
So wait a minute, you're saying that the NSA and a branch of the intelligence community in England, they were sharing information about citizens.
Yes, it was
from
under
the other country.
Yeah, and also
so they could spy.
That gets much more interesting too when we realize over here how many video cameras you have, and I know that's a know that's a subject people we do think about a bit over here and think is scary. So if you add that in, the sharing, then that makes it even more incredible.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, the UK's become a sort of police
state. We're already
horrified. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they have that. So in the UK, we have those three as the primary agencies. And then we have every county has a police force, and each police force has its own secret police section called special branches. And then we have the Revenue Service and Customs and Excise and Military Intelligence. MI5 and MI6 aren't actually military intelligence. Mm-hmm. So we've got this whole different range of different competing organisations that all want a slice of the pie, of the money from government, who then try and stab each other in the back in order to gain primacy and to rule the roost. And they betray each other and they don't work well together. And it's a real mess. And also, as you mentioned before as well, we have these sort of private security contractors where
so
a lot of the experts work.
Mm-hmm. Al Burton.
Yep.
We've done a bit of work with unearthing.
Yeah, no, there's lots of them now. I mean, there's Kroll as well, and Diligence is a new one, which was set up by a former colleague of mine, and that's now worth many tens of millions of pounds every year.
Wow.
So that really is a boom time for them. So it's a real mess in the UK, and nobody ever really knows what they're getting up to and who they're investigating, and quite often they're sort of running around after the same targets, or they end up investigating each other's agents, and it's a mess. And, of course, there's no real oversight either. They are the most secret intelligence organisations in the world, or certainly within the Western democratic countries. There's no proper government oversight, so they get away with whatever they want.
So you're the MPs have no authority at all.
Well, MPs don't have any authority anyway. They're just our democratically elected representatives, aren't they? They have no real power. No, over the intelligence agencies, they can pretty much get away, literally, with murder. They were set up 100 years ago in 1909. And for the first 80 years of their life, they didn't officially exist. So nobody could ever ask any questions about them. They didn't have to obey the law. They could do whatever they wanted. And in fact, they did. There was a whistleblower from the 1970s called Peter Wright, who wrote a very famous book called Spycatcher. They tried to ban it. And he said famously that they bugged and burgled their way around London with impunity. You have to be careful saying that.
They're still doing it.
Well, that was a bit of a scandal. And then there were a number of whistleblowing cases in the 1980s where people came forward and said, actually, they've been lying and they've been caught out. And the government got terribly embarrassed, so they actually had to put some new laws in place, including 1989, the Security Service Act, which governs MI5. And then 5 years later, in 1994, the Intelligence Services Act, which governs MI6 and GCHQ. So this was the first time they became official entities legally.
And what did they stipulate?
They stipulated that the organisations had to obey the laws of the land. So if they wanted to do their secret intelligence investigating and they wanted to, say, get a telephone tap on someone's phone or plant a bug in their house, that, of course, would be illegal for anyone in Joe Public to do that. So in order to be legal, they had to get the prior written permission from their political master. MI5 is supposedly under the control of our Home Secretary, and MI6 and GCHQ under our Foreign Secretary. So they were supposed to get prior written permission in order to make those sort of invasions of our privacy legal. Now, this sounds like democratic oversight, but in fact what they could do was get away with whatever they wanted, because the political people could never see the intelligence case. They were given a summary of a summary of a summary of the intelligence case, so the spies could pretty much put on whatever they wanted. And the politicians never, ever turned down a request because they were too worried about any fallout if something went wrong. So that is the sort of legal framework within which they work. The 1994 Intelligence Services Act also put in place a committee within Parliament called the Intelligence Services Committee, the ISC, which is made up of hand-picked MPs, i.e. those who are not going to rock the boat, mm-hmm. picked by the Prime Minister. Mm. And they are supposedly the Oversight Committee.
That's this the Oversight Committee.
But they've got no power.
They only get away with that in government. They get to be their own Oversight Committee.
No, this is
and
appalling.
And they can sell it. It works. And then it happens. And then we try to live with it.
Yeah.
But they always do seem to find the way around it. We have that same pickle here quite a bit.
We do.
But I would think the difference in the two systems would be a little bit more that our Congress looks over, or is supposed to, supposedly look over our systems.
Yeah. But you do seem to have more oversight. I mean, ours is only allowed to look at policy, administration, and finance.
Yeah, that is a big difference. And our system isn't working at all either.
No.
So we have nothing to doubt.
No.
But we do. I mean, from what I've seen, the American system is sliding towards the UK system. And
it is.
Many other democratic countries doing the same thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And well, the more that they can put the power in out of our hands and into the hands of people that we don't want to have it, the more that they're able to do that, the more they do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the intelligence elite.
The pickle is how to stop
the
them.
The intelligence branch mm-hmm. of the elite, possibly.
Oh, boy, the elite intelligence branch. Ooh, that just sends shivers.
But it exists. And we're discussing it now.
It's part of the corporate power grid.
Very much so. I mean, Britain, of course, is famous for its class system, you know, and it's still very much in place.
Ours is rapidly becoming a class system
There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's just based on purely money.
You have a little better wealth distribution than we have, a little better ratio. I just was looking at this.
Yeah.
You were very close, but you're a tad better, but...
We used to be a lot better, but it's probably for about the last 25, 30 years, it's gone really bad.
Thatcher.
Thatcher, indeed, the T word.
They're back, too.
Well, yeah, and Blair was Thatcher in, you know, in men's clothing, effectively.
Yes, exactly.
He asset-stripped the country.
But what does the culture or the climate of the intelligence industry in England look for? What I'm curious about the kind of people that they would recruit. Hmm. That was something I had thought about
where
on the way here.
Well, I mean, it has shifted over the last few years. Certainly in the old days, up until about 1980, perhaps the mid-1980s, it was very clichéd. It was very sort of upper-class Englishmen. Mm-hmm. Women, of course, were only allowed to work for the services up to the 1970s as secretaries and registrar clerks and things like that. And if a woman got married, she had to resign. She wasn't allowed to work if she was a married lady because, of course, then she was supported by her husband. So that was the sort of position. So there's a lot of ex-military types, you know, sort of crusty colonels with tweed jackets and moustaches.
Well, they did fit that stereotype.
They did, yeah. But then it did begin to shift. In fact, when I and David Shaler were recruited in the early 1990s, their work had changed. I mean, they had, even MI5 had realised that the Cold War was over by then. You know, the Berlin Wall had come down. So they were working towards more counterterrorism work. And that meant they wanted a different profile of officer. That's what they told us. So they wanted people from a wider variety of backgrounds. And they wanted people who could react to a fast-paced, evidentially-based investigation. So if you're investigating terrorists, back in those golden days, you were supposed to gather evidence and put them on trial in front of a jury of their peers, not throw them in Gitmo.
That's the evidence. Yeah, yeah.
So that was the sort of shift. They wanted people. But what they found in the 1990s is they got all these wonderful people, and then somehow they got me as well, but they got all these wonderful
people. Oh, you're just as wonderful, if not more so.
Just British, you know.
But they didn't know what lurked behind.
No, they didn't. They
did. Your heart and your integrity.
Well, actually, I think they had a bit of an idea, because I remember one of my managers saying, well, of course, I was warned about you. I was told you're a maverick.
Ah.
Well, I was quite chuffed when they told me that.
Wonderful. That's like a badge. He said, thank you.
Accused of being a loose cannon.
Yes, yeah, that was David. And a renegade. So, yeah, they shifted it. And they got all these amazing array of people, you know, very bright, very personable, very dedicated to trying to do some good. And they weren't the sort of crusty old colonel types. And then we had this huge, great clash between the two age groups. So the sort of senior management, being around for like 30 years, they were cold warriors. All they knew was how to investigate the Soviets and political subversives, up against these new young people who wanted to investigate terrorist groups and, you know, gather the evidence and what have you. So there was this huge clash, culture clash, and a lot of people left in the mid to late 90s, around the time that we did, for the same reasons, because they were so concerned at this inefficiency and unethical behaviour and unlawful behaviour, because a lot of these old boys didn't want to operate within the new laws either. They couldn't see the point. They wanted the glory days back. So there's always been a very high turnover of staff. And then, of course, since 9/11, there's been a massive recruitment drive. They've doubled the size of the organisation in about 6 years. And they are trying to recruit in from all sorts of sectors now, a lot of people from sort of ethnic backgrounds and more women and all that sort of thing. So I don't know what the mix is now, to be quite frank.
Well, they can infiltrate more easily, I'm sure, into different organisations.
Well, it's also the cultural understanding as well, I think.
Yes.
There is a split. If you work for MI5, it's not like working for the FBI where you're called an FBI agent. If you work for MI5, you're an intelligence officer. And you're a full-time employee and you organise the operations and run the operations and decide what types of investigation you deploy. But one of the things you can deploy, of course, are human agents. Those are the people who do go into the organisations and report back. So if you're an MI5 agent, that actually means you're not working for the organisation. You're like a sort of contractor and you're out there doing the dirty work. And if you're an officer, you're working for the organisation, organising all these different things. So there is that sort of split.
Yes.
Yeah. So in terms of penetrating organisations, that's not what the officers do. They would run the agents into the organisations. That's different.
I see. Yeah. And service being basically contractors or treated as such.
And they're treated badly quite often as well. You know, they say, oh, come and work for us, help your country, we'll protect you. But as we saw time and time again, certainly with the war in Northern Ireland, the agents who on a daily basis were life or torture or their family's, you know, death, or it was horrible. Quite often, if they ran into troubles, they wouldn't be looked after properly.
So you had to witness all of this.
David and I both worked for the organisation for between 5 and 6 years. So we had 3 separate postings each in that time. So, you know, we weren't there for a long time, but we saw so much going wrong in just that snapshot. You have to wonder quite how bad it is across the board, across the organisation.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what were some of the things that you witnessed that ultimately led you to become a whistleblower and to expose?
It was sort of incrementally worse as the longer we stayed. It's a bit like boiling a frog. You know, initially you think, oh, well, it's this section, it's a bad manager or whatever, but the next section will be different after you've moved a couple of times. Yeah. So I started working for the first 2 years in a section called F2. Bearing in mind I was recruited in the early 90s and I was told that I was going to be a counterterrorism officer and the bad old days of the Cold War are over and we no longer investigated political subversives and Reds under the bed. So when I first started working there and found myself in F2, investigating Reds under the bed, so it was a bit of a shock. So I worked in the political section, which I do say I was very pleased to help close down at that time. And then I had 2 different postings, one in the Irish counterterrorism section, one in the international counterterrorism section. So I saw quite a spread of different stuff. And that included illegal files on our senior politicians, a lot of politicians in the UK, because they all had their names checked in the run-up to the general election in 1992.
To keep them in check.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is a serious problem for a democracy.
I do, too.
You know, they don't know what the spies know
about
them.
Absolutely, I know. You know. And then what can be used against them. And we don't know what's going on, how their hands are being tied. Mm. We don't know what's happening with Obama. We don't know who's behind.
Yeah, yeah. The crazy thing was, after we'd blown the whistle, the guys who were supposedly the political masters of these organisations, the Home Secretary and the Foreign Secretary, were both men whose files we had seen. And they don't know what's on their files. So, of course, they do the spies' bidding. So it was a real mess. They're not allowed to see their files, even though they're supposed to be in charge. It's crazy.
Well, I wonder if we have that here, because I want to see the files. Let's find them.
Yes. Well, you could try. I mean, I know in some European countries, if you do freedom of information...
I wonder if we have that here.
Yeah. You can see your own files sometimes.
We do sometimes, but then so much is crossed off.
Does the FBI have a file on Dick Cheney, I would suppose?
Oh, they would probably tell him.
I'd love to see.
They would probably tell him it was to assess the threat he faces, so it's a protection thing.
I've just never considered that. That's delicious. I would love to have that.
I know. Well, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all false identities, so much. You don't know what's true, if there's any truth at all.
Well, there you go. That's just what I was going to say. The sad part is the whole system is there to bring out the truth, and that's what we would be supposedly paying for, or you're paying for, to give us a system where we actually have workable truth to use and utilize, and you'd call it intelligence.
Yeah. But it's
not. The product at the end, it seems like, is deformed by the political process that it had to go through to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't end up actually arriving at the product potentially that Do you think that it affected your product in the end? Did it affect, you know, going forward with systems that actually work?
Absolutely, because
yeah, of course,
you know, these systems are closed shops because there's no meaningful oversight, because they're protected by laws
shops,
like
yes,
the Official Secrets Act, so there can never be any dissent or criticism.
Sort of
about
like
them.
A black box.
Very much. They yeah, become a sort of self-perpetuating oligarchy. You know, you get groupthink, and if you rock the boat, you're a troublemaker.
Yeah, sure.
So the people, who do question either resign in disgust,
yes,
or they shut up and they sort of climb up the greasy pole. And therefore, you get a very self-defining sort of organisation. And I think, actually, this is what we're seeing now, where MI5 is being prosecuted through the British courts for complicity in torture cases of terrorist suspects. So in the 90s, they actually officially, their official position, they didn't get involved in torture. They knew it was counterproductive, inhumane, against the law, and you didn't actually get to the truth using torture. I mean, they knew that. I mean, it's just realpolitik. I'm not saying they had any ethics about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't use it. And now, of course, you know, 20 years later, they're in a position where they're in court accused of being complicit in it. And I think that's down to the groupthink. You know, anyone who says, actually, boss, have you thought this is against the law? We shouldn't be torturing someone, is quietly encouraged to find another job, perhaps. So,
or not so quietly encouraged.
Oh, they don't tend to fire people. They sort of would help, you know, them find other jobs in useful places. It's always good to have reliable chaps in useful places like banks and arms companies and, you know, NGOs and things like that. So
interesting.
They have a nice network. Oh, and of course the private security sector.
Ah, yes. Can you say a little bit more about the private security sector in the UK? It's grown quite large here. Bechtel, Halliburton. Maybe what percentage, or do you have any idea?
I don't know what percentage it is. No, I mean, there have been a series of scandals in the UK media over the last few years about people being caught out who are obviously completely cack-handed, maladroit, private spies going in and investigating activist groups, environmental groups, green, you know, lobby groups and things like that. So there was one estimate, they said, I don't know, I presume it was said half jokingly, that there was some big demonstration against the building of a new airport, and they reckoned about one in four of the activists there were actually private spooks. But because you have these layers, you have the sort of MI5 side, you've got the secret police side, you've got the private people. You know, I'm pretty sure that if you go to those sort of meetings and demonstrations, there, of course, are going to be people watching now. As I said, the sort of investigation of political subversion was shut down in the 90s, post-Cold War.
So but it went, I think, to the private sector.
Well, that's a bit different. So you get a position where the anti-war movement suddenly took off in the run-up to the Iraq War, and that caused political embarrassment. So I'm sure they will have reactivated some of their agents to go back into those groups, particularly as those groups were organised by the old subversive organisations.
Mm, sure.
Yeah,
so who specifically would fund that?
Fund
private organisations like that? Who
it tends to be big business, not government. Although the spooks, I think, use private organisations for deniability, of course. If they want to go around the law and they don't want to have to apply for a warrant to do something illegal or whatever, they can use that.
Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can set up corporations. They can go directly because there'll be some of their former colleagues in those private organisations, and that's helpful. So they just go and have a quiet word.
Or, seems to be worldwide.
Yeah, of course. And also big corporations do employ these groups. That's where the big bucks are. So if, for example, you've got an environmental camp blocking the building of a runway at an airport, then BA or E or, you know, one of the big the airport authorities might well pay one of these private organisations to go and spy and cause dissent and guide the sort of thinking of the group at meetings and things like that. So that's how it works. But it's a big growth area. It's a big growth area. And, of course, these organisations then also employ ex-soldiers, and they provide the muscle in places like Iraq and Afghanistan as well, the private contractors. It's just like the US.
Sure. Yes, it is. Mm. It is. And what led you finally to leave MI5? What?
Yeah.
You know, there must have been a sequence of events, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you probably spoke to David about it, and he had his reasons, and they were probably somewhat similar, but what was the final straw? And then what happened afterwards? I know you were on the run.
Mm. Yeah, literally on the run around Europe. I know, it's crazy.
Your family was threatened friends?
Yeah, all that. It, as I said, it was a sort of incremental process, like boiling a frog. So we saw the sort of illegal files on politicians. We saw the scale of the investigations into left-wingers in the past. I mean, it was pretty McCarthyist. You know, it's very sort of paranoid. And we saw attacks that should have been prevented, which were carried out by the IRA on the UK mainland. They could and should have been prevented. But MI5 just cocked up the investigation and then covered it up and lied to government. But then there was a straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, in the final sections we worked in international terrorism, there are two cases of false flag attacks, the first being the attack on the Israeli embassy in London in 1994. In this case, the two Palestinians were arrested, tried and convicted and sentenced to 20 years each for conspiring to do this attack.
Now, do you just want to give a definition of false flag operation for...
That's the concept where an attack goes ahead and is blamed on one group but is actually carried out by another. And quite often the other will be an intelligence agency.
Yes.
In fact, this happens time and time again across the world. It's perfectly standard technique that intelligence agencies use in order to change the public mood, to generate terror, to gain political advantage, to create the sort of public will for new laws. I mean, you know, we've seen it in the last... how many years with the war on terror, so that's quite standard.
9/11 going to Iraq is classic.
Yeah.
The Patriot Act was initiated and installed.
It's everything, yeah. We get all our old freedoms just stripped away and they've gone, you know. So that's what they've achieved off that one.
Mm. So it's just an arm for the power of that corporate power grid. It's just another one of those arms that it uses to get what it wants.
I wouldn't even just call it the corporate power grid. In Britain we have the phrase the establishment, is sort of, yes, it's corporate, and it's all media and intelligence agencies and the military. And yes, the focus is on making money and protecting their class interest. I would say it's sort of elitist interest rather than just corporate, because quite often there's revolving doors between all these fields anyway.
Absolutely, and it all feeds into each other.
Yeah,
here,
totally.
I think we're down to 10 corporations that basically own everything.
Yeah, no, I'm aware
of that. So that's kind of why we just sort of compacted down into that concept, because it does kind of hold everything in that idea.
Well, it's interesting as well, isn't it? I think it was Mussolini who said that the definition of fascism is the murder of the corporate and the state.
Yes.
And that's precisely what we've seen.
We're living under now.
We are living in fascist states by that definition.
Yes, so. We are.
And they're just different shades of that in England and here.
Yeah.
But similar.
Yeah. Just to go back to why we left, the final attack was the worst one we saw. This was in 1995 when David Shaler was the head of the Libyan section. And he was working very closely with his counterparts in MI6, the outside agency. And these guys were briefing him on an unfolding plot that they had been approached by a Libyan walk-in, a sort of volunteer. There was a Libyan military intelligence officer who'd gone into the British embassy in Tunis and asked to see the resident spy, because MI6 works under diplomatic cover. And he said that they had a plan to get rid of Gaddafi. He was heading up a group of ragtag Islamic extremists, as he called them. For that, read Al-Qaeda, whatever you want to make of that phrase. And he basically said they were ready to get rid of Gaddafi, assassinate Gaddafi, but they needed money to fund the coup attempt. And MI6 pretty much immediately started shoveling money at this guy, who became codenamed Tumworth. That was his code name. And they paid in the region of about $100,000 or $120,000 in tranches to this man, who went off and spent it on all the kit, you know, the jeeps, the tents, the guns, the weaponry, the explosives, everything. Yeah. And Dave was briefed about this over a course of a few months. But he was sort of used to MI6 coming waltzing in, you know, saying, oh, old boy, we've got another little operation, another little job, you know, this is all going to be terribly James Bond. And they were always big talk, but they never actually achieved much. So he sort of knew about this, but rather dismissed it. But then in February 1996, this intelligence started coming across his desk from a couple of different sources, saying there had indeed been an attack against Colonel Gaddafi of Libya.
Yeah.
Manifestly it went wrong, because Gaddafi's now, you know, the new best friend of our governments in the war on terror. But what happened was there was a cavalcade of cars coming back from the People's National Congress in a town in Libya called Sirte, and an explosion had occurred underneath the wrong car. Gaddafi was in a different one, and the people in the car died. Other people were killed in the ensuing security shootout. Innocent bystanders, you know, waving at the cavalcade and things. And they reckon, I think he saw about 11 people had been killed on that day. And this was the attack that had been funded by MI6. In fact, he challenged his counterpart the next time he saw him. He said, you know, what was going on? And he said, oh, yes, well, that was us, old boy. We did it. Well, and David pointed out, of course, you didn't, because Gaddafi's still alive. But they were just pleased. I think they'd pulled something off, and that was it. But... this obviously, I think, you know, it's a classic case of false flag terrorism, that they blamed the attack on this patsy group of Islamic extremists who, of course, were rounded up and killed. And it was also illegal under UK law, because going back to the legalities under the Intelligence Service Act that governs MI6 from 1994, This says they can do illegal things provided they get the prior written permission of their political master, up to and including murder. And this is the sort of license to kill, the fabled license to kill from James Bond. Everyone thinks it's fiction. It's not. This is written into the 1994 Intelligence Services Act. But they hadn't actually got that permission. So what they did was illegal under UK law, as well as being highly unethical and reckless and a very volatile part of the world. And that was it. That was the case.
Destabilising the whole nation.
Totally. I mean, MI6 for years at that point had been tasked with getting the two suspects for the Lockerbie attack back from Libya for trial in the UK. And they made no progress towards it. They were hopeless. So that was going to be their quid pro quo. They got rid of Gaddafi. They would hand over the suspects. And, of course, I'm sure oil contracts came into it as well, because BP is now back in Libya and making a packet, you know. A killing is the right word, perhaps.
Also, a killing in our marine wildlife, in our whole Gulf.
Yeah. So that was the case. I mean, after we saw that, we just thought, you know, we didn't sign up to get involved in organisations that get involved in organising terrorist attacks.
No.
So we left. We resigned and we blew the whistle.
So that's when you came out.
Yeah.
And then what happened to you as individuals?
Yeah, well, that was a bit of a weird story. When we were still there, I mean, we actually ended up resigning in the autumn of 1996. David had approached a journalist. As I said, there's this Official Secrets Act. You can't say anything to anyone ever. Even if you take the information to... Officer. Mm-hmm.
Officer, sorry.
That's different.
There is.
Yeah. Yes, because we had been employed by the Security Service, under the Official Secrets Act, to say anything about our work was a crime, and you get 2 years in prison for that. And you can't even go to your MP, because that's still committing a crime, because they have no oversight. There's nowhere to go. So David decided to go to the papers at that point and made contact with a journalist and developed a relationship, which took a while to develop because the journalist was sort of paranoid at some sort of MI5 sting, and David was paranoid he'd get shot. So it was a bit of a slow courtship. But eventually the newspaper ran with a story in 1998. They ran with the whistleblowing stories about other stuff first, like the files on government ministers and illegal phone taps and the low-level stuff. And for that, we knew that
was
we...
Was it an alternative paper or more mainstream?
No, you can't get more mainstream. It was the Mail on Sunday. There's a group, the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, which are sort of mid-market newspapers. And very right-wing. I mean, they are notoriously right-wing in the UK, but they are independently owned by a guy called Reichardt Rothermere. Every other national newspaper in the UK is owned by big multinationals. Mm-hmm. The Viscount Rothermere at that point hated the intelligence agencies, we found out. One of his friends had been done over by them, you know, years before. So the newspaper went with it. And actually, I think that was quite a good calculation, because if it had come out in the usual more left-wing press, you know, it's those lefties grumbling about the spies again. But as soon as you get a right-wing newspaper saying the spies are out of control and carrying out crimes...
Attention will be paid. Crafty.
So it was a weird
good
one,
choice.
But yeah. Anyway, so it sort of broke in summer 97. And we wanted to get out of the country. We ran from the country the day before the story came out. Because we knew that if we'd stayed, there would have been the knock on the door and the special branch would have arrested us and... we'd have been hauled off and held on remand waiting for trial, you know, for up to 2 years. So we went. We wanted to be free to carry on and getting the rest of the information out, including the Gaddafi plot, which the newspaper were too scared to run with initially. Yeah. It was too big. So we fled and fled to the Netherlands and spent a month literally moving around on the run across Europe, using fake names and, you know, different hotel every night and everything.
Were you being tracked there?
Yes.
Could you feel it, or what were some of them?
Well, we knew they would. I mean, that's the trouble. Having worked there, we knew quite how paranoid we should be. So I don't know. No, we did find out subsequently, and from the trial papers and things, they chased us. They lost us before we left the Netherlands. So we ran from there down to France and things like that. So, yeah, a month on the run. We knew they'd take out an injunction against us to gag the press from further reports. We also knew that once they did that, the press would be jumping up and down saying, you can't do that to us, we're the free press. So that happened on the Saturday.
Smart.
At the end of August. And we thought, right, the media is going to be on our side now. They're going to fight for an inquiry.
You would think.
Well, they would have been. We went to bed quite happy that night after about, you know, the first night's sleep we'd had for days. And woke up the next morning to turn on the French news, because we were in France at that point. And the first thing we heard on the news was, La Princesse Diana est morte aujourd'hui.
Oh,
so Diana had died in Paris that night. And you couldn't make it up in terms of just losing any sort of media interest and protection, and the fight for the inquiry, everything just disappeared.
Oh my goodness.
So, and we travelled through Paris that day as well. So I think we had like a team of MI5 after us, and there was obviously some sort of spook coverage of Diana as well. It's like the Keystone Cops in Paris.
What timing.
So, well, thank God the story didn't originally come out that day. I mean,
yes.
We sort of found ourselves lost on the run in Europe, and with no media protection anymore. So we did that for another month. We made contact with the Civil Liberties Union in the UK. It's called Liberty. And the head of that became our lawyer, a beautiful graduate called John Wadham, who fought for us. And I went back after a month, knowing that I'd be arrested, and not knowing if they were going to charge me with anything and keep me on remand or not allow me to leave the UK. So David and I were sort of facing up to 2 years apart at that point. And I went back and I was arrested, but I wasn't charged. I hadn't really done much by that point. And they just kept me on police bail for 6 months.
So you were able to walk freely?
Pretty much. I had to keep going back to the UK to answer bail until they dropped the case. But I had the chance to go back to what had been our home and found that had been absolutely trashed by the police.
What a violation.
Yeah, they'd ripped it apart like a sort of counter-terrorism style search. I mean, you know, floorboards up, bath ripped apart.
While you were in France.
Yeah, yeah. And they had only a warrant saying they could take anything pertaining to our work with MI5. Of course, there was nothing there, but they took bin loads of our stuff, including a lot of my underwear. And you're talking violation. My underwear drawer had been pulled open and the knickers all pulled out, and it looked like they'd been playing with them.
Oh, that's
them lying on the floor, I know.
Oh.
So, yes, I wasn't very happy.
Sick old boys.
Yeah. But it got worse, because then the next day, the day after I'd gone back, I heard from the lawyer that the brother of David and his two best friends had been arrested in coordinated dawn raids on trumped up charges, for which they were never charged, never prosecuted, but they were done with a maximum of effect, you know, to try and put pressure, I suppose, on David to shut him up. You know, look, we've got your brother, we've got your two best friends. And they went round to my family's place and got seen off the property, scared off the property by my stepmother in a baseball bat and things like that. It was great.
She came out with a bat.
She did. She said, I want to see your warrant. You haven't got a warrant. You're getting this. And they went.
That's great.
So,
they didn't have their SWAT team coming in. That would have been uncalled for, I would think.
Yeah. But our poor families were traumatised because we thought our phones were bugged and all this in the run-up to the whistleblowing.
Annie, what have you gotten into now?
They found
Look
out.
What you're doing.
They found out by reading the papers.
They didn't know.
No, they had no idea. So it was a bit of a shock for them.
Shock after shock after shock.
Yeah, it was pretty intense times.
Did they know that you were an officer or
yeah,
agent?
Yeah, they did.
They did.
Yeah.
They knew that.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously that we'd resigned and we were really, you know, disgusted with what we'd seen, but they had no conception we were going to go public. So that was pretty
hard. What courage you have.
Foolhardiness, I don't know. I mean, this was all a long time ago now, you know, sort of in my 20s. Yeah. And, you know, I look back and I think, God, did I really do that? That was bonkers. But
well,
I'm glad I did.
It takes a warrior to stand up for the truth.
It does. Mm. It does.
Yeah, it does.
Well, David,
thank you.
David, well, thank
you for
you.
Doing that. And tell the underwear story over and over and over. That's a great one.
That's disgusting.
Because that's incredibly sick.
It is. Shall I say? It actually looked like they've been sniffing them.
Oh,
oh my gosh.
How revolting is that?
Oh, it is.
Revolting, that's good.
And deprived. Also, some of those guys I worked with, I knew them.
Maybe they did it intentionally to threaten you more. Who knows their sick minds?
I know.
They're just proving their nastiness.
Yeah. That wasn't nice.
So what would you say is the media complicity in all of this? And not just your experience, but the complicity as a whole in the States and the UK?
I think it's very controlled for a number of reasons. I mean, even in the personal story, I saw it
fear
close. Yeah,
so much that people are terrified to even act. Mm. They're the terrorists.
Yes, well, this is where terrorism comes from. People think terrorism is a bunch of, dissidents or beardy weirdies in the Middle East, you know, carrying out bombs. Terrorism started as state terrorism, where the state uses violence in order to create an atmosphere of terror in order to control their population. That's what terrorism comes from. It's state terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism. You know, people still forget that. Yeah,
I know it started here when we came over here and massacred the Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if people forget it. I don't think they've ever realized it. especially in America.
Yeah,
and I would say I have some family over right now from Sweden, and I have some connections there, and I've been talking with them about, you know, what they know about media. And then when they come over here and talk to the population and see America is a little bit more choked, and I almost hate to say a little bit more, but I don't want to be incredibly derogatory, but our situation in the media is much more dire than yours for different reasons.
Oh, it's appalling. I mean, you know, it's just propaganda channels, and I'm not mentioning any names.
And so we have 305 million blurry watch people. And that's the superpower.
Yeah.
So we should all be terrified. And the people who are supposed to be our security are sniffing our underwear.
You're our security, Annie.
This the is underwear
not good.
Sniffers.
No, it's not.
Underwear is pursuivant to the queen or something. I can see it now.
Oh, I can see the badge. G-string on there. Okay.
Yes, people used to wear stockings as face masks. Perhaps they just put the knickers. Anyway, let's not go there. But no, I mean, in terms of the media, it's it is very controlled in the UK still, and there are various levers within of power that they use to control it. I mean, obviously, there's the concentration of ownership that still happens in the media as well as in the UK, in the US as well as in the UK as well as in the US. But we also have a lot of laws to circumscribe press freedom, like injunctions, which was taken out in David's case, like control of journalists with the Official Secrets Act. They are prosecuted too under it, Section 5. In fact, some journalists around David's case were arrested and prosecuted and one convicted.
What's Section 5?
It's part of the Official Secrets Act. So they were prosecuted. You know, they can use that against the spies. They can use counterterrorism against journalists. They can use counterterrorism legislation against journalists as well. Britain is famous for its libel laws. There's a volunteer committee made up of spies and senior media types called the D-Notice Committee that self-censors. Plus, there's a sort of informal establishment chaps sort of circle, you know, of boys who went to the same public schools and all know each other, and oh well, they have a quick word with a friend in one of their gentlemen's clubs and say, well, you don't want to listen to this David Shaler guy, you know, he's a fantasist or something. So that becomes the mythology around the media in the UK, that, you know, this, that, the other is the case. He was sacked,
now,
he was disgruntled,
there
he wasn't.
Is there any alternative media to question this or to counteract it?
No. Well, I mean, I suppose the Daily Mail group...
that's the right wing?
Yeah, that's the one that broke our story. Had the owner, the Viscount Rothermere, who was very anti-intelligence because one of his friends had been done over by them. So he was pretty good, but he died and he's been his son has inherited and he's less independent-minded, should we say. But that's about it. I mean, you know, the BBC is notoriously propagandist now as well.
You have India media over there.
Independent.
Indymedia, yes.
Yeah,
Of course we do. But again, even that...
can't compete,
no.
Just like here.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you have much different rules around journalism than we have. We don't have the prosecutory issues that you were talking about. So you have that dynamic too, but you were also talking about being prosecuted for participating in torture, which we don't have. We don't have anyone, you know...
Yeah.
So you have different dynamics, but seems to be achieving the same purpose.
Yes, I've been real curious about the situation over there and how it's playing out.
It's bad. It's really, really bad. You know, the UK is almost like a locked police state. In fact, I don't live there anymore. I left and moved.
You got out while
you
could.
I went to Germany last year.
You could see it coming.
Wow.
Yeah, to escape the fascism of the UK state.
Germany.
That's incredible. Yeah. That's a great commentary. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's great. Germany is wonderful. It's almost like they've got their fascistic sort of bit out of their national psyche. You know, they've had that
moment.
They
figured out it doesn't work, so they've moved on.
They figured it out, and they've got this amazing constitution, which is rock solid, to protect everyone's basic rights. And even when the government now moves to try and overturn bits of it, it's being rejected by the courts. They're saying, no, we've got this constitution for a reason. We don't want to be a police state. We don't want to have the SS. Torturing our citizens. We don't want to have a Stasi-like state like in Eastern Germany. So they're standing up to it.
Well,
England,
great.
England, the empire, and we've become the other empire, and they maybe are not about to relinquish that, and they're not coming, the roost is coming home.
No, but I think it might well be the case. I mean, the Brits have certainly seen themselves since the Second World War as, you know, always the good guys. They either defeated fascism, you know, they can't imagine they're not now.
Belly clubs or... clubs. When I was traveling over there.
Guns. They are armed to the teeth, machine guns, everything, everywhere. You go on the London Underground, around airports, whatever. Yeah, I mean, I come over here and I don't see so many guns. You know, it's ridiculous. You walk around London streets.
I had no idea.
Yeah. They had tanks parked outside the airport.
A police state.
Yeah.
And what about all the cameras?
Yep.
How are they used?
Not very well. We have over four million CCTV cameras. That's just publicly owned CCTV cameras, like local councils and the government. Then you've got all the private security cameras everywhere as well. So God knows how many we've got.
Being observed.
Yes, they reckon if you walk out of your front door to go to your place of work in London, you're photographed at least 500 times a day.
Be afraid to breathe.
Yeah. No, it's horrible. But the head of the section in the Metropolitan Police that runs the CCTV network has actually gone on the record and said, CCTV does not make people safer. There's been an increase of violent crime since we started putting them everywhere. And they are actually only of use, evidentially, in the solving of 3% of crime. That's it. They're useless. But they're there and people feel safer and that's it. But they never work when you need them. When 7/7 happened, the underground, the bombing of the London Underground, there was no proper CCTV footage. You know, and these guys were on four different trains. One was on a bus.
But don't you... Now, that was a false flag operation.
We don't know.
Neither do we about ours. I mean, ours was definitely...
I'd say that there's a lot more evidence for 9/11 than 7/7.
When you look at the evidence, you just can't walk away. And you just can't.
No.
It just makes no sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, it just would be so fantastic to pin that on him. Wouldn't it? I just want to get the thumbtack and pin that right on his forehead. I really think we can.
I think the evidence is there to do it. I mean, you know, there is so much credible evidence out there now that contradicts the official account, at least. Of course, there should be a proper investigation into 9/11. But with 7/7, we haven't even had anything like the Truth Commission, which, of course, we all know was set up to fail, in the words of their chairs.
Absolutely.
You know, we've had one thing that came out so far, which was an anonymous narrative. It was called a narrative written by, an anonymous civil servant, the official narrative. And it got its facts wrong. So they had like 2 years to write this thing. And within a day, the Home Secretary had to go into the floor of the House of Commons and say, sorry, we've got some of this wrong. And the reason he did that was because independent researchers, just like with the 9/11 truth movement, had actually found information. And one of the key discrepancies with 7/7, of course, is that the train which the official narrative, which the government said the terrorists got on, didn't run that day. It was cancelled because our train system is crap because it was privatised 15 years ago. So trains are cancelled every day all the time. So this train was cancelled. And the reason we know it was is because the researcher had gone to the train company and said, can I see your performance indicators, which you have to legally keep? And he got the list of the trains that had run that day. It just wasn't there. So there was no train. Those four men was, you know, should have taken. There was no train that would have got them from the station outside London Luton to London on time to have carried out those attacks. Yes.
Find another cover, quick.
Quite. That's a weird one. But
how
the other
did that play out in the media?
It didn't. The media has got a blackout on it.
I have a funny feeling that would be your answer.
No, the media is so anti. I mean, they won't touch 9/11. Well, occasionally they will just to diss the truth movement.
No,
but they certainly won't go anywhere near 7/7.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
And what is often the case, too, is they have operations before the actual terrorist attack. They call them mock operations of a sort. And weren't they having one at the same time?
They were
time?
Indeed, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this one was stark.
Yeah, I wonder why. Do you know anything about those? I don't know.
I mean, if it's a false flag, why, and I'm certainly not saying that in the case of 7/7, I would say, knowing as I do that false flag exists, I'm blowing the whistle on it, you know, always look at any major attack with that in the back of your mind as a possibility. But as I said, I don't think there's enough evidence around 7/7 yet. But yes, in this case, we had a man called Peter Power, who was a former senior counter-terrorism officer from the Met Police, who is now in the private sector running something called Visor Consultants, private security contractor.
Open door.
Yeah, well, revolving doors quite often.
Revolving door, yes.
And his company had been running an operation for a London-based company, which is still nameless. And I actually heard him, and many, many people did. He went on two national media outlets immediately after the attacks. One was ITN, which is a TV station. One was BBC Radio 5, and that's the one I heard. And he said, immediately after the attacks, Visor Consultants running this counter-terrorism drill in London at precisely the same stations at precisely the same times as the attacks occurred. We had to go live, and he said the hairs on the back of his neck stood up when he heard this because of the coincidence. Now, I don't know.
That has happened in other flag operations.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That was the same thing on 911.
Yeah, and with Madrid bombings as well.
We know that. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The details around that and how we had no security actually there where the other airplanes were. And I mean, it's just lists and lists and lists.
Didn't they pretend as well? So Condoleezza Rice came out and said something like, oh, we had no conception they could possibly do what they did with the planes. And yet they'd had an exercise precisely like that a couple of years ago.
In fact, the cover of the paperwork they were using that day, I think, or in a previous exercise, had the World Trade Towers and the crosshairs.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the cover of, was it not the cover of PNAC, Project for New American Century, Rebuilding America's Defenses as well?
I'm sure they probably put that in their paperwork also. I have no idea.
But I don't know, in terms of why they have these exercises, if we go with the thesis that it is a false flag attack, and if it goes wrong or whatever, then they've got cover. I suppose that's one way of looking at it. Or they might want to have exercises so that people having, you know, witnesses are there to say, yes, we saw these dodgy-looking men with, you know, beards and rucksacks or whatever.
Maybe.
So it's planting evidence. I don't know, that's one other way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been curious about that, but we have to end in about 5 minutes, unfortunately.
Time always flies.
It does. I need 5 hours.
It's been fantastic to hear this story, and it's so similar to what's happening here.
Very much.
Yes. And that's, you know, the project that we really work on, and our focus is truth to power, hoping that bringing the truth forward to the masses.
Well, keep doing it, please.
So maybe that's something we can walk away with today, just as citizens and people, you know, as we try to find what is actually going on.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we'll bring that truth to power.
That's why we're
Thank
so grateful
you for
that you're
doing
here.
What you did, really.
Yes.
So much blessing.
Thank you to do.
And
what
you.
Advice
wonderful.
Do you have for all of us? What can we do?
I think we all need to educate ourselves. You know, don't believe what you see in the mainstream media.
Absolutely.
Go out and find out for yourself. Do the research. And then get active as well. Because I think we're in a bit of a race at the moment between the powers that be sort of cracking down, taking away all our rights, and us waking up people enough in enough time so that we can say, no, we are democratic citizens. We have certain rights and responsibilities. We're not giving away any more power. Mm-hmm. And we need to get people aware and active and, you know, take back our democratic power. This is our right. It's something our forefathers fought for and gave their lives for.
Yes.
And we're giving it away too easily. And this ends in atrocities and wars and torture. And, you know, enough's enough. Time to stand up.
Thank you, Annie.
Absolutely. Get up, stand up.
You're going to be the keynote speaker Friday night.
Everybody one of them.
Everybody come.
Do you want to say a little bit about
the
conference?
Tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. It's something that I and some other activists have been working on because, you know, there's many, many people questioning these issues, especially the 9/11 truth movement. So I've been very active in that movement in Europe and did some work, started discussing this with Gabriel Day, one of the key organisers of this conference.
He was on this program.
Oh, he's brilliant, yeah.
He is brilliant, he and Jason.
So we wanted to look at not just 9/11, but also put it right at the heart of all these interrelated issues, like evil corporations and media control and manipulation and the economic meltdown and the erosion of our civil liberties and the wars and everything. Because 9/11 is like a nexus point. It brings together so many of these different themes.
Yes.
So it is key to it, but it's bigger than that. So this conference is looking at all these interrelated facts and issues.
Shadowy.
All the sort of issues we've been talking about today and way more. There's a fantastic lineup. People like David Ray Griffin, Michael Parenti, Ellen Brown, Ian Crane, Barry Zwicker, many others.
Just escaped.
Yeah, please do, because
Wonderful.
They're all experts. They've done a lot of research and their own experience in their lives and everything. It's going to be a fantastically rich conference.
It's
not just talking at people, but trying to come up with solutions and involve everybody. So it's going to be fun.
I wish I had a schedule, a lineup of who's speaking and when, but you can go online to Understanding Deep Politics. Is it .org?
.org, yeah.
.org, and get all the information, how you can register, and it's very reasonable. And it's Friday night, I think all day Saturday night, and then most of Sunday, and there'll be panels where most of the speakers will be sharing, and you can gather with the other attendees, and it's going to be wonderful.
It's going to be good, yeah.
Find the solutions as well.
Yes. Now, that's the key bit. I mean, you know, many people are aware and they're angry, but they don't know what to do. It's trying to find workable solutions that can help us all and stop this sort of slide towards totalitarianism, which is what we're all living under.
And everyone's going to be there listening to you tomorrow night, all of us from Santa Cruz, and there are many coming in from the outside as well.
Well, I better not stay in the social hour too long then, in the bar.
UCSC conference, and no, we'll drag you out. My grandmother was... it's British, so when I hear you speaking, I pick up a bit of her accent. It's so easy
That's
to slip
wonderful.
Into.
It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. Yeah. I hated opening my mouth when I was in England every time because I sounded so drawl.
Drawl.
I think it's very relaxed. Mm. It's much nicer. The English sound a bit uptight, so you know,
no,
if you have your Californian drawl, you sound much more laid back.
I'm from Boston originally.
We're best when we're all together.
Yeah.
Which we will be this weekend. Mm-hmm. That's great. What a wonderful conference.
I know.
Thanks for
Thank you.
Coming.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much, Annie. Yay. Now we're going to be waiting for Barry Zwicker to call in, or I will probably call him, and he's also going to be a presenter at the conference. Do you want to say a little bit about Barry, Annie?
Yeah, Barry is an amazing guy. He's a very senior journalist from Canada. And he's been very key in building up awareness of the lies around 9/11, the official narrative and everything. But he's also written some books on the concept of false flag terrorism, all the different attacks, how many our countries have been involved in over the last 100 years, as well as also media control, media corruption. So he's amazing, a spread of experience and research that he will be presenting at the conference. And I had great pleasure, I've met him a few times over the years now, but I had great pleasure last year meeting him in Toronto, where he did a sort of stage interview with me, and we had a brilliant time on stage. And we also went and shouted outside a big convention where Clinton and Bush were doing a talk for hundreds of thousands of dollars each. So a load of sort of 9/11ers and peace activists went down there and, you know, had a big demonstration as well. So that was great. Yeah.
Fantastic. Wonderful.
Oh, we got to do more of that. Wonderful. Great.
Timing. Well, thank you so much. And I think right now I'm going to put on Beautiful Existence, if I can find it. Let's see. For our listeners, and I'll get Barry.
Capitol Hill Tuesday.
Whoops. No, we have something else coming on. I think I've got it.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
I'm still learning this computer here. Whoops, there we go.
Oh, that sounded good. That sounded nice, Cindy.
I just lost Beautiful World.
Well, it's coming.
Let's see.
Beautiful World is coming.
We'll put on some LOL. They're the activist lawyers.
Activist
from
lawyers.
Pakistan.
From Pakistan.
Musicians.
That's what
that's amazing.
What we wanted. It's perfect.
Let's see if they're coming on here.
Absolutely.
Here we go. Well, thank you, Annie.
Well, thank
we're gonna
you.
Get
that
Barry
was really
right
fun
on.
As well.
Maybe
it's really
calling
pleasure.
In.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What a great
उम्मीदें शहर
Welcome to the second hour of Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the Heartland of Santa Cruz. And I'm Janaea, and with me is Hope for Peace. And our second guest, we're real honored to have Barry Zwicker on. And he is amazing. He is a Canadian alternative media journalist, documentary producer, and political activist. He is most famous for his documentary work, which has dealt primarily with 9/11 conspiracy theories. And he, whoops, someone else has just arrived here in the studio. Hello.
Jason.
I don't know who this is, but we'll find out. And he is also he produced The Great Deception. It was his first documentary on 9/11, and it aired on Vision TV. And then The Great Conspiracy, the 9/11 news special You Never Saw. And in this work, he contends that fear was used to control the public after 9/11, which most of us know, and states that the war on terrorism is a public control mechanism. And he is an authority on false flag operations and much, much more. I want to get him on now. Let me see if he's here. Hi. Barry, are you with us? Barry? Hi, Barry, are you with us? Whoops. Barry, hi, there you are.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Your voice there was very, very weak a minute ago, but we're all connected now, are we?
Yes, we certainly are.
Very good, loud and clear.
Yes, we are. Well, welcome to Free Radio.
I'm happy to be with you.
And you're going to also be speaking at the conference this weekend.
Yes, on Saturday morning. I believe they have me marked in for 9 to 10:15 a.m. slot.
9 to 10:15 a.m. Wonderful. It's going to be an amazing conference. And I have a co-host with me, Hope, and someone else who just arrived. And I have no idea. Who are you?
I'm Jason. I'm one of the event organizers.
Oh, you're Jason. Yes. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
This is Jason King. He's one of the creators of the conference. Hi, Jason's with us, too.
Very good, and
thank
I know
you.
That Jason connected you and me for this conversation.
He certainly
and
did.
I had met Jason in Keene, New Hampshire. He remembered meeting me, and I just recognized his face, and then it clicked in that, yes, we had a nice chat in Keene, New Hampshire about a year or two ago.
Ah!
Yep, he
old New England.
That. Wonderful.
I feel badly. I kept seeing this person. But let's get started with what you have to share. I'd like to know a bit about the dynamics in a false flag operation. If you can give us the how sort of decode it for us.
Well, I'll try. It's an interesting and very, very important area of history. That is the phenomenon of what's called the false flag operation. It's very important because these false flag operations, such as, well, 9/11 was the most brazen of all time, but you had other ones such as the Gulf of Tonkin incident that escalated the Vietnam War terribly,
yes.
Resulting in 58,000 American soldiers killed and 3 million Vietnamese. That was the non-existent event in the Gulf of Tonkin off the North Vietnamese coast was the justification for a bill put before Congress by Lyndon Johnson, which was passed 100% by all members of the House of Representatives, and it was passed 88-2 in the Senate. There were just two senators who opposed it. Of course, they're heroes. That was Senator Gruening of Alaska and Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon. So you can see the horrible outcomes of these false flag operations. And I should say, though, before mentioning a little more about them, that there are three categories, if you will, of false flag. And for listeners who haven't happened to run into this, the term false flag operation comes from naval history, which describes how a ship would run up the flag of its enemy so that it would be mistaken as a friend of that enemy, and thereby the ship could get close enough to the enemy to open fire before the poor devils on the other ship wised up to the fact that it was in disguise. And that's where the term comes from. Now,
it's happening to us, ordinary citizens.
Oh, yes.
We get close, a flag is woven in the name of patriotism, you're supposed to, all of a sudden, become very patriotic and deny what you see and
let them in close.
Truth.
This is true. You've got it. You've got it. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very effective because these events, they're usually attacks on one's homeland, and it has all the emotion that naturally arouses in the human breast. And so they're very effective because their lies, what Bakunin called the propaganda of the act. They are lies in the form of events, and they're very persuasive. And they're more persuasive than thousands of ordinary lies that are told by leaders all the time. Those are just like pea shooters compared to the atom bomb of a false flag event, an attack on your homeland. And the populaces who are manipulated by this all down through history have never once caught on. It's always done in secrecy, and it's so emotional, the truth is never revealed, because of course history is written by the victors.
Right.
So the aftermath is controlled as well as the actual execution being controlled. So this is very interesting. It's very important. It's very little known.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Now, I could add, if I may, that there are three categories I was starting to say. So one is the false flag event. That would be like the Reichstag fire in which the German parliament was burned in 1933. Which allowed Hitler to vault to power and then start World War II, which is also started by a false flag event. He claimed that Polish soldiers had attacked a German radio station just inside German territory on the Polish-German border. It wasn't Poles at all. It was people Germans had rounded up from jails, put Polish uniforms on them, and shot them dead. It's very convincing to find them. So there are those events. The second category is false flag agents, and those are people who are not who they seem to be. All sorts of spooks and spies who have legends and aliases and so on, and they do their surreptitious work in various ways. The third category is false front organizations. So you have an organization that seems to be doing one thing. I mean, it's like infamously...
Like oil industries that are part of the Bush family.
Well, Janeo, that might be a category. I'm thinking more of more noticeable incidents such as, or examples such as Air America. This allegedly, everybody believed it was an independent airline. It was totally run by the CIA.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, during the time of the Vietnam War. And so you have proprietary publishing houses, airlines, and businesses of various kinds in their fronts. They're actually not what they seem to be. They're being used as a fifth column. So those are the three. You've got events, agents, and organizations. So the false flag story is a very big one.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is.
I'm thinking back, too, and I don't know. Remember the details, but I remember studying the beginning of World War I. Wasn't Franz Ferdinand also a false flag?
Yes.
Yes, that was another one, wasn't it?
Agreed, Hope. As a matter of fact, Webster Tarpley. I've got a lot of respect for Webster. I know he's controversial, I know him. I think his work is very good, and in his book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, made in USA. He actually has a page or so on the assassin of the Archduke Ferdinand, and it turned out that there were intelligence agencies behind that individual. As a matter of fact, if you stand back a bit, it's quite amazing and really anomalous at how many so-called lone nut gunmen have decided to change history. Yeah. You know, Lee Harvey Oswald and James Earl Ray and Sirhan. And what a coincidence that the death of these leaders and the Archduke Ferdinand, to be another example, has been pivotal in changing history, almost always for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
And how does it happen that these individuals, you know, decide to change history? No, there are larger forces behind them.
Absolutely.
Usually.
And if you back up, then we've really covered the major wars that we've had, World War One, World War Two. We have Vietnam. We have, of course, Iraq.
Yeah.
It's a false flag. Any idea on Korea? How did that go in the beginning?
Korea is a very interesting case.
It's still going.
The brilliant investigative journalist I.F. Stone wrote a book called The Hidden History of the Korean War. And it's little known that John Foster Dulles, who at that time was the U.S. Secretary of State, I guess, he visited the 38th parallel, that's the line that divides North and South Korea, just scant days before the North attacked the South. And the North did attack the South. What was hidden, and this is a hallmark of a certain kind of false flag operation, what was hidden is the immense provocations that the South had
perpetrated,
done against the North. I mean, repeated forays and killings and so on. And you can expect if you launch a series of attacks that after a certain point the country is going to retaliate. But then they call it an out of the blue, unprovoked attack. That's the lie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that probably the Korean War started that way. Of course, to begin with, North and South Korea should never have been partitioned into two countries, because this, in turn, was an outcome of the dividing of the spoils after the Second World War, when the oligarchy in the USA already decided it was a marvelous opportunity to expand the American Empire really seriously. And so you had North and South Vietnam, you had North and South Korea. Germany was a different case. It was partitioned by the Allies. But anyway, these divided countries are a recipe for were a recipe to keep the Cold War going and to keep the big overarching template of the time, which was anti-communism. That was the equivalent of the War of Terror today. Anti-communism actually prevailed as a quasi-religion most of my lifetime. And then it was superseded by the so-called War on Terror. And the oligarchs always need an overarching narrative to manipulate the public into believing that they are facing an implacable enemy. That's the big trick of all.
And today it is so prevalent. You turn on the television and constantly you can hear terror, terror, terror. It's so much more prevalent than it was 10 years ago. They've upped the ante now.
It's unfortunate because we really live in the information age, so the potentiality for any citizen to actually know the truth is so much higher, and yet the level of fact that the normal citizen has, to me, seems to be absolutely declining.
Well, there's a double movement there. I think most people would agree that we do live, and it's not, I think, an exaggeration, at a historic crossroads.
I think so, too.
Yeah, we really are.
And
you can tell it spiritually, politically, and also, of course, from the point of view of the environment, where our planet is under severe attack.
Absolutely.
We're using 125% of our resources. That can't go on. So one of the phenomenal changes or trends or developments, of course, is in communications. The internet being probably the most prominent of the communications factors, so that with the internet and the offspring such as Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and so forth, and the emergence of a huge number of cameras, both surveillance cameras of all kinds, and also cameras that people have, people's video, if you will, in their cell phones, so that you're getting
Those are ammunition, though, sometimes.
Pardon?
Those can present the truth sometimes.
Oh, yes.
That paradox again.
Almost all these things are, if you will, to use an old-fashioned phrase, double-edged swords. But so mm-hmm. there's a kind of a double mm-hmm. movement whereby mm-hmm. An increasing number of, shall we say, ordinary people, that's a strange phrase, but what I mean is people who are not in power do not have a vested interest in grabbing power and expanding it and seizing it and maintaining it. Just people who are living their lives, ordinary people all over the world, have more and more access to instant communications of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a vast network, wired and wireless community, if you will, of human beings who are plugged into each other on an instant basis and can exchange all sorts of information in text form, images, audio, video. So this, and as we know, the latest in neurophysiology shows that our brains actually change mm-hmm. as a result of the information that we take in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that what's happening is some sort of what Peter Russell, a Brit, who back in 1982 wrote a book called The Global Brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a video or film at that time that was based on his book, The Global Brain. And what he said is that there's this vast network which almost organically represents a global brain. And so out of a global brain, you could get a new global ethic, maybe an ethic mm-hmm. of survival or an ethic of cooperation rather than the old ethic mm-hmm. of divide and conquer and always have an enemy, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that since he wrote the book, I believe he's still alive and he's still writing. He has a website I visited briefly. We now not only have a global brain, I think we're getting a global super brain. Where,
I agree with you.
Yeah, it's growing and growing.
It is.
Now, it is only partly in the control of the oligarchy. And I don't think we can actually be too sanguine and sure that we being, shall we say, ordinary people, I keep using that phrase, will have continued access to the Internet. It's in the capacity, it's in the capacity of the oligarchy, or I call it the diaboligarchy, because it's the biggest, worst mm-hmm. oligarchy we've ever had,
mm-hmm.
that they can actually mm-hmm. shut off the Internet
absolutely
for people they want. In other words, they have the capacity through their neural networks to cut off me and you, people they consider to be dissidents or radicals or troublemakers or whatever,
yeah.
and let other people go ahead and use the Internet. I mean, that's mm-hmm. I believe that's electronically feasible.
And I believe they're in the process of doing that as well. By the way, my computer hasn't been working, but...
That's an interesting thing itself.
It is.
Yeah, there's something called Internet 2 that apparently they've developed, whereby
really?
The whole of the Internet would just be closed down, and Internet 2 would immediately kick in, and Internet 2 would look a lot different than the Internet we know today.
Everything would be deleted that I love.
Yeah, the corporations and the military and so on, and all the approved official organizations of the elites and the establishment would be thriving on Internet 2, and we would all be pushed off to the back of the bus.
Yes.
I've heard a great statement around that. It's he who controls the information controls the world.
Absolutely.
That's about it.
Or controls the stories. Do you know who said that? I've been asking people that lately. People have said Mark Twain.
Anybody know?
Well, the as a matter of fact, I think what you'll find
mm-hmm.
is that...
many people have said that.
Not exactly many, but that if you check out the quotations, you'll find a number of quotations that are similar to that, just a few, a half
mm-hmm.
dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is by George Orwell.
Ah,
and
of course.
It went along the lines of he who controls information controls the present, and he who controls the present
yes.
controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. It goes something like that.
That's very quantum.
Yeah, you paraphrased it well if you didn't actually
yeah.
say it.
Excellent.
But it all
it's
goes
true,
back
though.
It all goes back hope to what you said in a much more succinct way is that control of information mm-hmm. is essentially control of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so
we're in a pickle.
We're in a pickle.
We are. We are. It's very dangerous. There is. Jason has a couple of questions mm-hmm. here. Jason King, he is one of the creators of this conference
Yay.
For our listeners.
We're so glad you're here.
And
Thank you.
He wants yeah. to talk a little bit about the conference. And also he has some questions for you, Barry.
Wonderful.
Hey, Barry, how are you?
Hey, great, Jason. Glad you're there.
Yeah, you just arrived.
And thank you for doing this radio interview. It's a great help. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
But, Barry, on top of everything you're discussing here, the issues of false flag, its history, its implications, there are also a lot of other covert elements going on at the same time, like within false fronts, within real people's movements. We have infiltration. We have provocateurs. A lot of this was brought out in the Church Committee report in the 60s. That was probably the last really public expose of, you know, the FBI's infiltrating peaceful groups and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Yep.
I mean, so could you talk on those subjects a little bit and bring that into the, mm-hmm. the aspects of how that interlocks with the you know, the false flag issues you were bringing up.
Excellent.
Well, yes, it's very important what you raised, Jason. And I wouldn't say it's problematical exactly, but I would say that there are those, and by those I mean a spectrum of people from those who are very kind and generous and peace-oriented and want to avoid conflict and have very good spiritual and humane values and would never say a harsh word against everybody. But people like that right through across the spectrum to people who are actually themselves agents, and their job, what they're paid for, is to create divisiveness and to disrupt and to undermine and destroy peace and social justice organizations and organizations dedicated to truth, such as the 9/11 Truth Movement. So one must be careful, not in the sense of being chicken, but just be wise about approaching this, because there are those who will, and I've, you know, been living this, who will jump on you and say, well, you're being divisive by even raising the question of CIA agents who are assigned to peace groups in order to disrupt.
Oh, if that's happening, we have to know about it.
Yeah,
so let's look at it.
I've actually encountered it. But, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right.
That
we have to face whatever problems or challenges we have, in as intelligent and humane a way as possible. Now, there are 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. They employ 200,000 people. Now, all those are not agents on the street, but that's the staffing of it. They have, according to the New York Times, an annual budget of $44 billion. And, of course, that doesn't include the black budgets, such as CIA international drug running and so forth. So,
and then the private industry.
Well, again, you have increasing so-called intelligence work in the corporations. That's right. And this is a huge establishment, and obviously it presents a huge problem, and it has been growing. So since the time of the Church Committee, as Jason says, when COINTELPRO was revealed as being a terrible thing whereby peace groups and civil rights groups and so on were infiltrated, and there were attempts made, and some of them unfortunately successful, to disrupt these groups and cause infighting and so on, and yet, as Jason says again, it hasn't been since the mid-70s that this whole huge establishment, which has only grown since then, has been examined publicly. There may have been, I'm not up to date with all my U.S. Legislative history, and there must have been at least one or two committees that looked into this. But anyway, nothing serious, to my knowledge, since the 1970s, to examine the whole U.S. intelligence establishment, ask specifically, in a broadband way, what laws are they breaking, how big are they, what are they up to, and so forth. And so, if we come back then to the anti-war movement, I have got going, as a matter of fact, currently, some back and forth with some people in New England concerning whether there are agents within New England United, which is an umbrella group. Jason could tell you there's something like 75 organizations in it, a marvelous group, I'm sure. But anyway, the curious thing is that within the conventional peace movement, which I myself have been a member of since I was a teenager, by the way. And this is, we're talking all over the world. I'm in touch with people in Australia, New Zealand, not so much on the European continent, but certainly in the United States and Canada, not so much in Canada, but mainly in the United States, also in Britain, that you have peace groups or anti-war groups that not only refuse to examine, to ask any questions about the official conspiracy theory of 9/11, but they go out of their way to criticize and even be extremely hostile to anybody who does want to question the official story. Now, just on the face of it, sort of applying the scientific method, we have a right to ask, how could that be? How could large numbers of people who are for peace, genuinely for peace, who are progressive, they're for social justice, they're for closing the gap between the rich and the poor, all these good things, they're against...
So they say.
Yeah, so they say they're against militarism. Well, I think a huge number of them are absolutely genuine. But anyway, how would it be, especially that their leaders would en masse refuse to approach the subject of truth in connection with this 9/11, the biggest, most brazen false flag operation of all time that has caused three wars, the Iraq War, the Afghan War, and the War on Terror, so-called. How could they remain, going on 9 years since the events, oblivious to this, the import of it, the facts of it, when there's a mountain of evidence on the internet, for instance, concerning it, forensic evidence, there's eyewitness evidence, seismic evidence, there's still photographs, there's video evidence of all kinds of evidence that there are extreme anomalies and contradictions and impossibilities and absurdities surrounding the official story. How could all these intelligent people who are otherwise very progressive and want a better world turn a complete blind eye for 9 years to this? I mean, you've got to ask yourself if something else isn't at play. That's all. I'm putting up a great big question mark there, and I think it's for the people who are in the peace movement and attached to it to answer that question. And I'm willing to sit back and listen very carefully to what they say in response to that question.
It is amazing that this last false flag, which is, of course, the most egregious, it happened on camera.
Yeah.
And we have all of this evidence for all of this time. And I would say in the normality of walking around on a daily basis, it's fairly unsocially acceptable to even say that you think the government had any part in it.
Yeah. Well,
because then it's
So all of that time has gone past.
Yeah.
We've sat here for all of this time and we're still barely able to have a conversation around it. That's amazing to think of the power of that.
If it's revealed that it was a false flag, it undermines the Patriot Act and so many laws that are in place now.
And if we continue in a country where that was a false flag and we don't face it, we're living the most disgusting lie that
I agree.
That you can really, and especially when you think of the Iraqis that died and everything around that.
I know.
Everything that's happening to us since then, it's...
Well, their identities and their association with being an American citizen is so shattered. It's fragile.
Well, there's so much to what you're saying. You're just packing in so many wise comments there, in my opinion, so many wise comments. And it is one I almost find solace, if you will, working on a book on false flag operations. And I almost find solace in looking at history, look at the long view of history, and see, regrettably, how often that similar tragedies and injustices have been perpetrated, and the perpetrators have gotten away with it. The tendency in history, and I'm relying here on a marvelous book called I'm just forgetting the name. Oh yeah, A Short History of Progress. It's an odd name. A Short History of Progress by Ronald Wright. And in this slim book, he goes back to the original civilization in Sumeria. And he tracks various civilizations on up through, you know, the Egyptian, the Chinese, on up through the various empires there have been, starting with the Roman Empire most seriously, and moving right on. And today it's the American, I guess you could call it the American Empire, But it's almost...
it is.
It's, well, it's... There's
the,
also
the United Corporations of America.
The United Corporations of America.
Yeah.
But also you've got worldwide corporations, mm-hmm. too. It's, I believe there's a networking of oligarchs.
Which is a subset of...
Pardon?
Which is a subset of...
Yeah. So that's why I call it the diaboligarchy, because it's the biggest and worst
I'm
one.
I'm going to write a song called that.
Okay, go to it. I give you my trademark.
That's fantastic.
She's a musician.
I love it.
So, but it's the biggest and the worst, and mm-hmm. I believe what it is mm-hmm. it's a network of oligarchs and mm-hmm. their dark organizations, you know, the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission and the CFR and on and on and there are even, you know, more secretive organizations we
mm-hmm.
don't even know about. So anyway, this regrettably the if you look at the history as Ronald Wright does, mm-hmm. What he finds, and this started with the invention of agriculture, because for the first time when they invented agriculture, it permitted excess wealth. And it permitted people to specialize, that everybody didn't have to be out hunting and gathering. So there was enough food that some people could become accountants and some people could become priests, right? And of course, a lot of people were farmers. And so then you had the division of labor, which then creates what we call civilization. And then you have to have leaders. You have to have organization and governance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, here's the sad reality. I think it's been pretty well proven by... By the way, most history books don't emphasize this. In fact, if they even mention it.
No, they don't go... No,
they
it's
don't,
slanted.
You know, history is written by the victors, again, mm-hmm. and the establishment has its establishment view of history, which suits its interests.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what Ronald Wright says, he mm-hmm. is an historian, but he's not a conventional one. He says that every civilization has developed into an oligarchical form of government
mm-hmm.
because the wealthy get... more wealthy because their wealth enables them to gather more wealth. You know, it's kind of a... There's a moment.
And then the monetary mm-hmm. system is set up so that they can easily...
Yeah,
they
exactly.
set it up. More wealth and create... Wealth and power
reserve.
Create more wealth and power.
Exactly. And
mm-hmm.
now,
as
we saw, which was a contributing factor to this brief but historic collapse of the stock market
mm-hmm.
a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where
mm-hmm.
suddenly it was the greatest drop in value, well, at least paper value in history.
Yeah.
But then it bounced back up again within a couple of hours.
Somebody just bumped the knob.
Glitch.
Somebody in the office where they keep the knob, where they turn it up and down, just accidentally dropped their Coke and bumped the knob with their butt. And then they went, oh, crap, we bumped the knob. And then they all turned it back up again. Crap.
Well, actually it's maybe...
There you go. Let's make it official.
It may be worse and also funnier and also sadder than what you think.
It always is.
Yeah.
That's why we have to laugh.
But apparently there grew up sort of an urban myth right away about the fat finger syndrome,
mm-hmm.
where this one trader supposedly was supposed to press the M button for millions and press the B button for billions.
Yeah.
But that's been pretty well proven not to be the case now. But however, the point is that it's kind of the whole stock market...
We're conspiracy theorists here.
Well, you've got to be a conspiracy theorist because there are conspiracies and you've got to theorize about them.
You do.
But that's
exactly.
just truth seeker.
Hey,
we should just call
just
them truth seekers
that's put
and
on
leave
us
it
so
there.
That we're not taken seriously.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
No, but there's a normative, you know, there's
mm-hmm.
the put down.
Absolutely.
Put down version of conspiracy theorist, mm-hmm. which the eyes roll up to the mm-hmm. ceiling, and there's that tone of voice, oh, you're not one of those conspiracy
mm-hmm.
theorists. Or
they
more
see that on television, so they have to emulate that.
We should change it. You know, just change it to truth seeker.
Well, I've got problems with the word truth, actually,
because
you know, I mean, any
truth is relative.
What's truth?
Any demagogue can claim that he or she is speaking the truth,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
so when you get high on the abstraction ladder, you know, like the words like good and evil and everything. You know, George
mm-hmm.
Bush talks about evildoers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you buy that word evil and you agree to use it, mm-hmm. well, then you endorse his use of it. So he's
mm-hmm.
going to just choose who he's going to target as being evil.
And you don't want George Bush choosing anything.
No.
So that's a bad scenario.
but anyway, I think the rapid decline and then the rise again of the international markets,
mm-hmm.
which in scuba diving terms is called a bounce dive.
Mm-hmm.
You go down so far so fast that you don't get hit with the bends and you come right back up again and you're okay. But anyway, what it shows is it's kind of a house of cards. We always knew the stock market is a casino,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But now we know that it's a casino that really is very fragile. It's a house of cards.
Yeah.
I fear that, I mean, in a way, it'll be a good thing if it collapses because it's so unjust.
Absolutely.
That people should be dipping into wealth that's actually created on the backs of ordinary people, workers and poets and musicians and
yes.
radio show hosts and everything. and then we are part of a monetary system that can be dipped into
mm-hmm.
because the fruits of our physical and our intellectual and creative labor
yes.
are translated. There's a money sequence, and it's translated into, allegedly, into money.
Mm-hmm.
And then people in charge of the money, the banksters and the casino operators, they dip into it.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that, which, because the fat finger explanation turns out really to be probably an urban myth, but what is not an urban myth is that there's automated trading. In other words, these giant trading corporations mm-hmm. have got computers that decide when to invest, you know, $1 billion in German Deutschmark. Well, there's no German Deutschmarks
no.
anymore. But to invest $1 billion in something or a million okay. shares. And then this computer scans the financial horizon and says, okay, it's time to sell them, like 11 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
So this gives a whole new meaning to the term money machine. I mean, there aren't even human beings working for the oligarchs in that
yeah.
case. They've automated the robbery of the planet.
Yeah. It's similar to having drones in war. The guy just
yes.
goes in his office and
yes.
kills people all day long and then goes home.
We're divorced
yeah.
from
the
atrocity.
Kind of, same kind of idea.
Not me, but
yeah.
those that are pushing the button in the plane to kill.
That's a good parallel.
The bomb. Know.
That's a
true.
Good parallel. And the people who operate the drones, there's a bunch of them live outside Las
uh-huh.
Vegas.
You were listening to NPR today.
What, did they have that on?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, good for
fantastic.
Them.
Fantastic.
Good.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same kind of idea, though. That, yeah, it's set up, you know, wealth and power simply creates more, like we said.
Yeah.
There's you mentioned the word wealth distribution, and this is really, for me, it's really where the rubber meets the road, because everybody else like us can understand these kinds of numbers. There's a professor here at UCSE that does a really good study, and I just looked at it again. It's William Domhoff, Professor William Domhoff at UCSE, and the name of his website is Who Rules America.
Oh,
so
yeah.
it's just a wonderful site I go to sometimes. He's a great guy. But the statistics in there from 2007 were that 20% of America, their personal wealth
yeah.
was 93% of America.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the 80% at the bottom currently are trying to divide up 7%.
Oh, boy.
The
yeah.
difficulty with that was, unfortunately,
pennies.
The numbers I had seen before that were 91 and 9.
Right.
And, of course, in the 30s, I believe it was something closer to the 80% owned 20%.
Yeah.
And so we see that slipping away. And we must guess that as every percentage goes away, a few more million people slip into poverty.
Oh,
because
sure.
more and more of us... I mean, that's just deductive reasoning.
Yes.
But if I bring that up and speak it out loud, I am a commu-socialist fascist, whichever one is the flavor of the day. You know, you're just not supposed to talk
you're
about wealth distribution.
That.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're never supposed to speak of that. It's sacrosanct.
And yet so many people are losing
and
a lot.
And yet,
can't they look
by
around?
2050, the models would show the 80% are going to own 3%. So what better way for that oligarchy to take over than to just simply own everything?
Well, and that is the tendency. See, this is what Ronald Wright says in his book, Short History of Progress, that
Progress.
All civilizations arrive at the form of governance known as oligarchy, or rule by the few of the many.
Yes.
I mean, there are three forms of governance you can have. You can have dictatorship, where just mm-hmm. one, essentially one person running everything.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can have something that is called democracy, and there's varying degrees of democracy, and some of them actually worthy of the name, and the middle one, which is rule of the many by the few, and that has been the dreadful
absolutely.
Default
mm-hmm.
during history. So now we have it on a global scale,
mm-hmm.
but when you mention those American stats, they're terrible, and
mm-hmm.
this injustice is not only wrong, but it's probably unsustainable. Around
yeah.
the world, I would myself, and I'm no economist, would identify five economic levels, if you will. You have the super rich. Now, the super rich, for instance, three Americans, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, and I forget the third one.
Trump?
No.
No, it's not Trump.
No.
I just saw it. Anyway, there's
no, I saw it, too. He's not from this country,
name.
Maybe.
No, these are Americans.
Oh, these are all Americans.
And Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and the third one I can't remember, they have a combined wealth that equals 40 countries in the world.
Wow.
I don't know which countries those are, but probably Bangladesh is in there, but probably some larger ones, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an immense disparity. Now, give Bill Gates some credit.
Mm-hmm.
He is a philanthropist, too. And he and Melinda, they do give away a lot of money.
Well, those few
but
at the very
the
top,
they
have to
money.
Make them look really very polished and people that, you know, other people would be able to respect. They have to make them public figures that are acceptable and you know, respectable.
That's right.
For people.
Well, they are almost Bill and Melinda Gates with their foundation. They're what you might call the human face of capitalism. And so it gives a nice sheen to the whole monopoly capitalist enterprise.
Though, because they're very much a part of it.
Yeah, I screw up the world, but I donate a lot of my money back.
I will not change the structure of the system.
Well, no, but it,
I'm
no,
put
but
that in, on your tombstone.
Yeah, you could have a whole program about epitaphs. But you
know.
To give Bill Gates credit. You know, he actually did start off small, and he did invent something that was new. He actually was kind of value added, and he did just the right thing at just the right time.
All those wonderful capitalistic
virtues that felt he had too much.
But the thing is that there are different capitalists. There's no question. You probably know about the guy. His name is Anderson, and he was featured in that program, The Corporation. That was done by Mark Akbar.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he's the president of this carpet manufacturing company in Georgia.
Hmm.
And the guy really did get religion. He said, look, we've got to take care of the environment. And he had a long-term plan.
Right.
So, but anyway, but the thing is that Anderson and Bill Gates are exceptions to the rule. Most capitalists are just interested in maximizing profit and to hell with their workers and the environment and everything else. That is mainly based on greed.
And the culture that we live in does encourage that. Mm-hmm. It's a whole paradigm that we're living in.
The great thing that people say to me usually is if you don't like wealth distribution, try to be in the 20%.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, I know.
Wait a minute, you're not getting
it.
Well, I ran across a great quote just very much parallel to that, which actually referred to Americans in particular, and it went something like, well, only a few people can become millionaires, and all Americans who aren't think that they've got a shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
this keeps them
quiet and supporting the system when they've actually got no more chance of becoming millionaires than of winning a lottery.
The irony is the very people who are decimated by having to share less, right? So the very people who their lives are depleted because there's less and less to share, so it's harder for everyone to, you know, to try to get forward.
Yeah.
Those people support the system and call it patriotic and want it.
Well, that's part of the propaganda machine, too.
It's amazing, though. It shows you the power of
just
it
how
to
serious
me.
It does. I mean, I'm constantly,
amazing.
Just as with you folks,
people.
I'm constantly amazed and re-amazed and re-amazed again at the power of propaganda. But what I was going to mention is these five categories, if you will,
economically.
You've got the super rich.
Yep.
And we talked about them a bit. Then you have the rich.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your 20%. Then you have the middle class, the poor, and the poorest of the poor. And and I would put the dividing line between the rich and the super rich on one hand, and the middle class, the poor, and the poorest of the poor on the other hand. I mean, it's just an arbitrary decision. The middle class is being hollowed out, and being pushed down to being the poor. The poor are being pushed down to becoming the poorest of the poor.
And isn't that what we tried to get away from with America, was to create a middle class?
Yeah, and now we demonize the
homeless. And we can see it slipping away from us. I mean, those numbers are not arbitrary. That's not a conspiracy theory.
No,
that's the fact.
Oh, they're absolute numbers. I mean, you could get them from the IMF,
for sure.
You know, these
Russia has better wealth distribution than we do.
And the reason this is not getting out is because of the media. It's not being accountable to the facts. It's not.
Yeah, well, the media are, you know, It's been the case historically, and I sort of bring back deep, not very deep history when you're talking about the media, because from the time that Gutenberg invented the printing press, and then it was quite a while before you had the earliest newspapers in England, and then it goes back to 18-something in the United States, where you had the penny press in New York City, Peter Zangler and those people. So actually the press is a fairly recent invention. It had to follow the invention of the printing press, and it had to follow the development of enough people you might have called middle class that they could afford literally one penny for a newspaper. Of course, a penny was worth more in those days. That's where you got the term the penny press, you see. And then you could have mass distribution of ideas. Now, in the early days of the press, we should go back to the 1920s, a little earlier, and then into the 1920s. For instance, New York City had 13 newspapers, and they didn't claim to be objective. Same with Toronto. Toronto had about the same number, about a dozen newspapers. Now, some of these papers were put out by trade unions. Some were put out by churches. Some were put out by political parties. Some were put out just by eccentric well-to-do people. And some were put out by cooperatives. You still have a co-op newspaper in Canada, Le Devoir in Montreal. And then, as for churches, the Christian Science Monitor. I mean, that was formed by the Christian Science religion. Mm-hmm. So there was some diversity, you see, in the ownership and control. That's the key thing: the ownership and control of media.
Absolutely.
More and more, it's become corporate. So now, almost entirely, corporately owned and controlled.
Five corporations only. So
those corporations have a value system. The value system is corporate capitalism or even monopoly capitalism, and the top values are growth and profit. Or in these days, because it gets complicated, because old-fashioned newspapers are suffering a lot for reasons we take another whole program to discuss. But anyway, survival comes in too, not only growth and profit, but also survival, and then in the hope you can live another day in order to return to growth and profit. And by the way, did you know that there's this huge war going on between Rupert Murdoch and the New York Times?
Oh, well, I know a little bit about it, but not too much.
I don't know much about it.
I've seen it in the media, just because Fox is always, you know, against the New York Times and Krugman, and there's sort of like the media thing going on there.
That is right.
Yeah.
That's all part of it.
Well, the visible part.
Well, that's the visible part, but actually a good deal of this is visible, and partly thanks to the New York Times. Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal, and he has a plan to either kill the New York Times or, you know, buy it off, merge it, whatever, because he's like a shark. I mean, this is one of the most vicious guys who ever lived in the media universe, anyway. And so what he did is bought the Wall Street Journal, expanded the coverage beyond economics and finance, which was very much on the right wing and supporting capitalism.
Absolutely, sure.
To have regular city news and entertainment sections and so on. He's putting out a dead trees version of the Wall Street Journal in New York at a very low price. It's a loss leader, and moving, encroaching right into the New York Times territory.
Wow.
And so the New York Times actually isn't as well funded as it used to be, and so the New York Times, is having difficult times.
They are struggling.
The board met. I subscribe, to the New York Times daily. I subscribe to five newspapers. So anyway, one day I open, it's not just on the front of the business page, it's on the front page of the New York Times about the meeting of its board. And they decided on a corporate strategy. And the corporate strategy is last man standing. In other words, they're looking at the death of newspapers across America, like the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or San Francisco, and the Rocky Mountain News. A whole lot of papers are dying. So, but there are people who turn to newspapers, and I think within the understanding that the whole thing is terribly propagandistic in favor of the oligarchy. But sort of, if you can, sort of put that aside for the moment. But then newspapers of the different media are just a shade better because they have more space and they're less propagandistic than television, for instance.
that's so debatable.
It is debatable. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yes.
I'm not putting this forward as
right.
a solid thesis.
Right.
Definitely not. I'm just.
This is what's happening.
I'm just riffing here.
Yeah.
Just riffing.
Sure.
So there are these hardcore newspaper readers like me, like geezers like me. And so our papers die, and now we look for another newspaper that of record, if the New York Times, or that, so that if the New York Times already has the most visited website of any newspaper, and they want to attract more.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is Murdoch has found out how to monetize his news on the Internet. He's charging, and he's in this giant struggle with Google and so on.
Right.
In order to, he wants to charge. New York Times is giving away its information on the Internet. They haven't found out how to monetize it yet. So they're actually, within the capitalist camp, you do have genuine struggles, like lions and elephants, you know, to the death in the jungle.
Right.
As a matter of fact, there's a news, Canadian newspaper magnate, Kenneth Thompson, and he inherited his father's newspaper empire, the Thompson Empire. And Kenneth Thompson, I met him, he's a very gentle, nice guy. And he inherited his father's newspaper empire, the Thompson Empire, which then merged with Reuters and so on. It's very big still. And what he did was actually build on his father's empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a successful capitalist. And when I went into his office, there's this giant picture behind his desk.
Yes.
And it's an elephant stomping a lion to death.
Right?
And I say,
they
well,
are
what
pretending
is,
they're
what?
In the jungle.
I said, what is the meaning of that
behind
picture?
Their millions, billions, trillions.
Well, what he said was, it's to remind me how the world really works.
Oh, gosh.
These are the people
the
that run our reality.
The way they filter their
lovely.
World.
It's just fantastic.
You know, Barry, we're going to have to wrap
no,
it up
no,
in a
no.
few minutes.
Sure.
And I really want to have you back. You have been unanimous here. You've been incredible.
Yeah.
And I just want to remind everyone that you're going to be speaking this weekend at the Deep Politics Conference. And what time are you on again?
Well, I'm on, if I recall correctly, at 9 on Saturday morning.
Yay.
I believe that
nine.
We speakers have like mm-hmm. an hour and 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
which is a nice bunch of time,
sure,
actually,
great.
As things go. And I'll try to have at least 20 minutes of Q&A. But
great.
But I would just encourage you to encourage your listeners,
yes,
anybody, to sign up for the whole conference.
That's right.
And they still, I believe, have tickets
mm-hmm.
and
yep.
And their discount rooms
the
at a block of hotel
yep.
Rooms. And I really
yeah.
think that when you, not, I'm not talking about myself at all, but the lineup of Peter Dale Scott
mm-hmm.
and
I
Ellen
know.
Brown, Cynthia McKinney regrettably can't come because mm-hmm. her mother's
oh.
ill, but and they've got Peter Dale Scott, Michael Parenti, it's just a tremendous lineup. And I am personally just looking forward to, and David Ray
yes.
Griffin,
yes.
I'm looking forward to meeting, I've met a lot of these people, luckily, over time, but I'm looking forward to meeting new ones of these brilliant speakers and thinkers and meeting the ones I already know, and just all of us, Peter Phillips too, of Project Censored, and
yes.
all of us getting together and having these great panels. To discuss how can we find a way through and out of the present diabolical system.
Yes.
How can we move forward to a safer, saner world with
yes,
different values?
Yes.
I'm going to suggest that
coming.
The Pentagon should get a new mandate.
Yes.
We need Project Pentagon, where they would take this incredible inflated resources they have and devote them entirely to oil spills and to clearing,
yes.
cleaning the air. And
making
and
sure our children
ending
have a planet
atrocities.
To live on.
Yeah.
That could be good.
Of course, Dennis Kucinich is all in favor of a Department of Peace. And,
yes,
but
he
why
has
not
been
just take
years.
The Pentagon
mm-hmm.
and turn that, the biggest
mm-hmm.
sword of ever, ever into mm-hmm. the biggest plowshare ever?
There you go.
Well, we're just getting started, and this
well
conference
said.
Is an amazing starting
Manifest.
Place. And the
yes.
listeners, the audience will be able to participate and
yep.
meet with the speakers and meet with one another.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's so many here in Santa Cruz that are already mm-hmm. very active. It's just going to be very juicy
yes.
and
yeah.
wonderful. And Jason's right here.
Yep.
He's going to speak
I just wanna,
about it a bit, too.
For your listeners, I just want to reassure everyone that you can buy tickets at the door. A lot
Yay.
Of people were worried
show
that they sold
show
out
up.
Or they didn't know how. But just everyone, please just show up and you can get your ticket right at the door. And also, if you're in your local coffee shop, pick up an issue of The
yes.
Connection, because there's a center spread article in there, a 2-page article written by Byron Galitzos, who's one of our advisors, that really goes through a very full description of the speakers and the program, and you'll really be well informed about what's coming up if you happen to be able to pick up a copy and read that article.
That was a tremendous analysis.
Yeah,
we're lucky if we
about the shadow government and what it really is, and the term deep politics, and it really lets you know what we're up against right now, the severity of it.
Right.
So, we're lucky to be in Santa Cruz. Everybody get in your car and come over.
So thank you very much for having our speakers on the show, and we really look forward to putting on a great event, and we invite everyone to
show
up. Thank
you for your hard work.
Yes, and do you just want to give us a review of who's coming on and maybe what time and how much the tickets are? And
yes, well, the tickets are anywhere from $25 to $110. If you just want to come in for one evening, it's
$25. That
if you want to show up, for just one day, it's $60. If you want to go for the entire weekend, it's $85 to $110.
What a deal.
$85 being if you're a senior or a student, right? And, one thing I should mention is that, you know, when Cynthia McKinney told us she was unable to come because of her family health crisis, we were at the last minute really lucky in being able to get Dr. Dahlia Wasfi to come. And she's an activist on the issue of occupation in Iraq and Palestine.
Oh, fantastic.
And we saw her give a presentation at a conference in Philadelphia just a couple months ago, and she is a knockout. So you're really missing something if you know, to have the experience of listening to her experience. You know, she's the daughter of her mother is Jewish, her father is Muslim.
Fantastic.
You know, she spent 3 months in Basra. She had the direct experience of the occupation personally. Mm-hmm. She has family there, and she's a real campaigner for ending the occupation in Iraq. So,
where else can you see 10 amazing presenters?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They're all going to be there sharing basically what are we going to do about the mess?
Absolutely.
The situation
there's a lot of talk in 2010
about what
patriotism is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different opinions about what patriotism is. And I think it can be clearly defined by people becoming aware and being able to vote in the best interest of the people.
Mm-hmm.
I think if George Washington or any of our founders were around in this particular pickle, I bet that would be something that they would be able to share with us. That's what we gave you, the ability to vote in your own best interest.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get up and find out what's going on and we learn that truth, we're able to actually do and function as we're supposed to as Americans.
Yes.
So thanks for giving us that opportunity.
I know.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
we're
absolutely.
They worked hard.
What a ball.
Gosh,
what a fun time.
Amazing people together in one room. Can you just imagine
great
the work
energy.
That's involved?
Yes.
I know it. For us.
Great energy.
Well, thank you again, Barry, if you're still
thank
there.
You, Barry.
Oh, the energy is coming through loud and clear from you guys.
Right on through the radio.
I'm right here in Palo Alto just with the electric, blue electric lines around me from all the energy that's coming
that's
through
really
the phone
nice.
Line
we're into red. I have to turn you down a little
so
bit.
We're so glad to have you, and we really would love, we can't wait to have you back. I want to just do one last quote.
Sure.
This is one for us all to keep in mind. It's really short. The victor is never required to admit if he told the truth. And that's Adolf Hitler.
Oh,
wow.
There
how
you go.
Appropriate.
An excellent, excellent
thank you.
Quote
yes.
to wind
glad
up
I ran across it one time. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Good to see you. Blessings on your day.
And likewise
you.
To you
yes.
guys. And we'll see you, Jason.
You bet.
And all the best to everybody.
Yes, you too.
Thank you.
Oh,
bye-bye.
Peace.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Wonderful. Well, our next guest, I have to go out and find him, is Dr. Darrell Wilson, and he is a Native American elder, and he's going to be speaking about the origination of thought and two moons. He'll be sharing that, and then the origination of North America and much, much more. But right now, I'm going to play Free as a Bird.
Jawline, it's alright.
And get your sound check.
Jawline,
adjust the chair. Free radio Santa Cruz. Hi.
Come along, come along.
Inside.
Don't be afraid. Down on my lonesome to the wind that in his travel has stung my face with holy grace. These lines like laughter crying. Na 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 na, be free as a bird. Na 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 na, na 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 na, come on, free, oh, free, ah. Na 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 na, hey, 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 hey. Na 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 na, free, hey, yeah, yeah. Oh, collect from your day gone by all the things that are gonna get you by, 'cause the road is right here before us. And you know it goes on and on, drifting out. Just you and Lady Fate, and could you believe it? Just you and Lady Fate. I say forever where you can find me, and this is where you and I. That is free as ever, and I give to you, you know it's true now, free, oh, free, oh. Every time.
sun, I am as they are one. Footprints stretch on here forever. Footprints behind us together. Many eyes have beheld this hallowed ground. In Lakesh, in Lakesh, the only sound.
Okay, good afternoon. We're still tickling the belly of the beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz on Free Radio, and this is 101.1 FM. And as always, we're looking for donations, and those can be sent to P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. And I'm real excited today in the studio live. We have with us Dr. Darrell Wilson. And he is a storyteller, educator, and author of The Morning the Sun Went Down and Two Moons, which I have been reading. And it truly is taking me deep inside of myself in an interaction with nature and exquisite beauty within the world that my eyes don't often see. He has an ability to bring what is around us very present in the natural realm. And he's going to be speaking with us on many topics, the landscape, what the landscape really is, thoughts, and then his latest work, Two Moons, and what Two Moons is. And with us also is Greg. He brought him in, and he's going to be co-hosting with me. Hi, Greg. Want to say a little bit about yourself?
Oh, yeah. I'm Greg Castro, and I've been a friend and a student of Darrell for many years.
Oh, many of us. Yeah.
And I'm Rumson Ohlone and Tetralis Lenin. So my homelands are just a little south of here.
Ah, just a little south.
Just a little south.
Well, thank you so much. I've tried to get Darrell on for a long time, and then when you offered to bring him down, I was thrilled.
Well, any time people can hear Darrell.
I know, it's so rare, and he is so rare. What he has to offer is precious. So, Darrell, hi.
Hi.
Just speak right into this little microphone here. There you go.
There. Can I say hi to all the good people in Santa Cruz?
Absolutely.
Okay, hi, good people. And some of the most beautiful families are on this side of the hill, but there's still some in San Jose. Greg is a product of that. He's brought me over, and it's really nice to be here.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, and I've been enjoying Two Moons. But I would like to start off by asking you about thought and where thought comes from, as your elders taught you.
Well, there's, I have to go back to our legends, and our legends, of course, go back long before the earth was ever made, and long before even the universe was made. In the legends, it just simply says that thought is the first thing. Thought was all alone in the vastness. The vastness, then, what they think about is like all the stars we can see at night, and beyond that, 10,000 stars away. And that's the vastness that they talk about. And thought was the very first thing in the vastness. That's where it come from. It just came.
And then what did thought produce? What did...
Thought is an extremely powerful event in our lives, and most of us don't treat it with much respect. But thought was all alone in the vastness, and thought for a while, the old-timers said, for a million years or more, and thought, all of a sudden, I would like to be something. What can I be? So thought for another long time and said, okay, I would really like to be a voice. And so voice was in the vastness. Thought and voice were there. And then thought and voice. And they said, I'd like to be something beautiful, not just a voice. So they thought. And voice turned into song. And song turned into the power that created what we know as the universe. But it created many more universes. We just can't see them or know where they are exactly. But thought being first is the most powerful thing that we have, and we really should respect thought a lot more than we do. And in the morning when some people go out and look at the stars and you think you can see the furthest star in the universe, that's just the way it goes.
And goes. So what would you, I'd like to ask you where you were born and say a little bit about your childhood and the landscape and how it impacted you, what the mountain meant, the names, and how they were changed later by the invaders.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. Just give me a second so I can adjust my
hearing aid. I'll break it down.
I know
sure.
You're talking about landscape, but
yes.
I don't know what it is.
First of all, Daryl, where were you born? Can you tell us about the area that you were born in and your name?
I was born in a very magic place. It was made magic. I was born in Quetzalli, which is now called the Fall River Valley. And it's in northeastern California, about 40 miles from Mount Shasta. Quetzalli is the name of the valley. But the I just was born there accidentally, like everybody else. But the reason the valley was made is because there's the Mount Shasta right there nearby, and it is the most powerful mountain in the universe. Not just according to legend, because according to what its purpose is and what it does. We can get into that sometime. But there's a big river that runs under that mountain. And the river wanted to come out of the ground somewhere and go across the earth like another river, any other river. And so the powers were thinking about this when the earth was being formulated, and the powers made Quetzalli exactly the place where that sacred river comes out of Mount Shasta, right in to the Fall River Valley, and it runs into Itajuma, which is by anthropology called Pit River, but that's not a name, that's an anthropological identification.
Yeah,
so
that's a good point.
They're absolutely beautiful place, and there's too many people there now. So everybody don't run up and look at that beauty. Take turns, or something. But it's absolutely four different seasons. You can tell the day summer arrives. You can tell the day autumn arrives. You can just feel the day when spring or winter arrive. It's just four distinct things, and you know exactly how to live. And what kind of food to prepare, and what you can use through the winter, you got to get in the fall. And if it's salmon, you got to get them out of the river and dry them out, sand them salt them down a little bit, smoke them a little bit, put them in a big basket so you have salmon all winter. It hasn't happened since 1904, but that's the way it's supposed to be. Okay.
And what happened to the salmon?
A crime happened to the salmon in 1904. In order to make electric power and power to turn turbines to create electricity for lazy people, there was a big dam put across the Sacramento River in 1904, and the salmon could not get home because they had to go a little ways up the Sacramento River and fork off into Itajima and then go home. But the dam just stopped that whole cycle of salmon. And you know what? PG&E doesn't even think about it. I mean, it's not changing a whole life system for the native people. Of course, in those days, they want to starve us to death anyhow. It's part of that plan. But bears on the river and ants on everything fed right off of the salmon run. And things in the river, we don't even know what eat salmon, but they do. Salmon eggs feed things all over.
We call it an ecosystem was destroyed.
Yes.
Without a second thought for the lazy people. That's what you said, and it's true. What can you say about the landscape?
The landscape?
Yes, that.
Oh, you want to hear about how it was made? I know how
yes.
it was made, but that would take a long time. But I know how this little bay here was made. It's all in the legends, and it takes a long time to tell that. But Mount Shasta, being one of the most powerful mountains in the world, is also one of the most beautiful, and it's 14,310 feet tall. And Mount Lassen is 50 miles away, and it is a tall mountain, a massive mountain made out of volcanic eruptions. But there are all types of evergreen trees and rabbit brush and the sunrises is something very special, and the sunset is something more special than the sunrise. I don't know how that works, but that's the way it feels.
Yeah. We once talked at length about Christopher Columbus.
Christopher Columbus?
And I was taught that he discovered America. And you disagreed with me. You just basically said, nope, you don't know what you're talking about. Can you share that with our listeners? Because a lot of people don't understand who discovered America, or why it was even discovered, or was it even discovered?
Well, that's like, this Columbus business has been so scrambled by history for many reasons. Most of it to cover up something somewhere else, just like cover-ups today.
Oh, yeah, we just had intelligence. Someone, a former spook here from England.
Cover up bombs dropping in Afghanistan by doing something with a gang downtown and got everybody looking at that while the bombs are still dropping. That type of a
cover-up.
You know, stonewall confusion. American history is basically an awful lot of confusion. And the people, every historian I have ever been able to talk with, and my native friends that are historians, I have a hard time talking with them because they go right along with the scramble. And the history they write almost all starts with Columbus. And I tell them, look, our history began before the earth started turning around the sun. That's where you start your history. Don't start it with Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus was a very lost being, wandering along in a little boat, and he accidentally bumped into some land. He was really looking for somewhere else. At the end, he was looking for anywhere else. He'd take anything. So he landed in this beautiful part of the world. But maybe the listeners would understand my grandmother better, because the one time I tried to explain to some of my elders when I was in the second grade, I thought I was pretty smart.
About Columbus?
About everything. So I was telling them that about this Christopher Columbus guy and how he found us. And they asked me, well, how? Where'd you get that information? Well, it's in the book, and I read it in a book. I thought I was pretty proud of my effort. I read that in a book. Anyhow, the old grandma was listening, and probably pitying me quite a bit at that point. But she said,
"Yes.
Did this guy find the sun too? Because our homeland has been no more lost than the sun."
And got the point across.
That is beautiful. I just love that, what she said. I can still see her eyes and her mouth and the way she turned a little bit like a grizzly bear and looked at me. I thought, oh, I'm going to get something now. I did get something. I got to learn something really quick and forever.
Yeah.
But when you scrape all of the propaganda away from Christopher Columbus and Queen Isabella, that's a decoy for you to school children to somehow look in that direction instead of looking at the reality. The reality, the real part, is it Christopher Columbus and 30 other ships went out from Spain. They went out for one reason. That was to find precious metal to bring back to the king and the queen. You can find this information in Christopher Columbus's letter to the sovereigns. It's in his book. Anyhow, Christopher Columbus came this way and landed on this shore. And I'm sorry, everybody, he was not the sweetest smelling person after 45 days at sea. And all the disease that his pirates brought with him. And about the next time he came, they brought a lot more disease, but a lot of animals with disease, mm-hmm. which really damaged the animals who were here just as much mm-hmm. as the diseases in the first ship attacked the native people here and killed off millions and millions of natives, north and south, and it's still mutating. A little doctor out there listening and find out a cure for the stuff that Christopher Columbus brought, and you'll find a cure for everything.
Get an inoculation, H1N1, H1N2.
Yes.
But he was on a mission for the Queen. And that was to bring fine gold and to bring it to her. She needed a lot of money. I said, well, why did she need a lot of money? She's in Spain and got a castle to live in. Just like everybody else, they want more and more and more. Well, the more that the queen wanted was to buy an army of 5,000 mounted and 50,000 on the ground. 50,000 feet on the ground. The purpose of that army was to march on Jerusalem and quell the Muslim voice forever. But it's not in your history book. You get to college, it's not in your history book. You got to go and find that for yourself. But you can, and you will, some of you.
There were Muslims here, the Moorish from southern Spain.
Mm-hmm.
I've had someone talk about that, too.
Cabrillo was one that was sent out, too, to get gold, and they got a college named for him right over here across
where
the hill. Nobody reads his history. They just say, oh, he was an adventurer.
Yeah. And your latest book, Two Moons, can you share with us why you call it Two Moons? I thought there was just one. Where's the second moon?
Two Moon is a expression from a wise man, a really wise man I was fortunate to know when I was young. He always liked to talk to us, and when I say us, it'd be myself and my brothers and cousins. Everybody has a lot of cousins. Well, in the summertime, we'd all band together and run wild through the mountains, eating pine nuts off the tree and roots out of the ground, and if we could catch a fish, we'd eat it. If we could find a rabbit run over on the road, we'd eat that too. So we did basically survival in the summertime. And
but you were free.
He wanted to see us. One of those things, hey, that's the law. He thought a thought, and the thought found somebody, and somebody said, hey.
Hadutsi law means thought.
Hadutsi law means thought, thinking, and the final product of that thought.
So the image, it's creating.
If you create with a thought, yes.
If you have the capability of
creating. A thought is very versatile, and so you can do almost anything with thought. I mean, I get a lot of messages from thought. I open up my email, and there's a letter from somebody about what the message was that came through the air.
It's like the happens. Red telephone.
Better than the telephone, yeah. Don't need to pay PG&E or ITT or any ATTT.
All those T's. They have to be crossed just so. But I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were talking about two moons.
Two moons, yes.
You were in a truck and someone wanted to talk with you.
I'm trying to build a little foundation here of how it came. The wisest man in my life sent for us with a thought, and he found us out in somewhere. And somebody found us and told us that he wanted to see us because he liked to teach. And he was so full of wisdom, not something you get out of a book, a wisdom, something that comes with pure thought from the center of the universe, that type of wisdom, completely full of it. And he didn't have anybody to give it to. He's looking around for somebody to give wisdom and thought and power. And these things, too, there wasn't one. So he got us all. And we weren't really prepared for that type of thing. So he got us all. His little yard, because we couldn't fit in his little house, because he had a little. His house was as big as this room. And he lived there almost all of his life, 100 years or more. But he always liked to talk. The time when the moon was full, he lived in a place called Atuam, which is now Big Valley. It's east of Redding, east of Burney, and before you get to Alturas, Big Valley. He lived out there, and it's just a big valley. He lived out there all alone, him and a couple of squirrels, I guess. but he wanted to see us during the full moon, so we went over there, and he never had anything to eat but canned beans, so we didn't get anything to eat at his house. But we didn't come there to eat. I came there wondering what it is he could be possibly wanting to say to any of us. I mean, you know, if he was counseling a wise counsel of wise people right there, I could understand it. But talk to a whole little flock of
kids.
Sixth and seventh and eighth graders, it just didn't make much sense. That there we were. There was the moon coming up. He took us out there, and he pointed at it. He said, "What do you call that?" And I was racing through my brain trying to figure out full moon in the language. How do I say full moon? Because they'll think I'm really stupid if I don't say full moon in the language, because it was a full moon. So I'm wrestling with the full moon, and somebody in the group said, "Moon." And he said, "Well, a lot of people call it the moon. In legend, that's the first Earth." Which made me just really think about this condition of this Earth. See, the moon has it, and basically a dead planet, nothing alive there. Not water, maybe a couple of drops, but not much. So he started telling us a story, and that's the story of two moons. And what, how much time do we have?
Oh, you can go on. We have about 25 minutes.
Okay, if anybody out there can listen for 25 minutes.
Oh, sure they can.
Here we go. Stan Rushworth's class knows that I talk and talk. Keep him an hour after the class. Still talking.
It's rare. You can't hear it anywhere else.
But anyhow, he continued showing us the full moon with his story, and continued his story about what turned out to be two moon. Two moon is because it's the way he said it. For no other reason, the way he said it. We'll get to that in just a little while. So he said, "You see that scar? The moon has big scars all over it. Mm-hmm. You see right there where the fire was? Do you see there where there used to be water? It's all dry. You see there the big hole in the ground? Somebody exploded something there." So we're looking at the moon, and he's pointing out all of these things to prove one thing to us. And he said, "There was a big war on First Earth. A big war. Terrible war. And so he let us sink in, just like I did, and everybody starts jumping over here. I could see him. But did it sink in? What was he getting at? So he says, "Well, the moon at one time was just exactly like here. There were herds of deer, herds of geese, bears everywhere, hummingbirds, flowers growing, roots growing in the ground, salmon coming up the rivers. It was just like here. Spring was beautiful. Autumn was beautiful, just like here. And then, one day, nobody knows from where it came. But two thoughts came. And they came to the first earth. And one thought said to itself, this is all mine. I'm going to use it for me. The other thought said, no, 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 wait a minute. You can't do that. 101.1. You can't have the moon for yourself and use everything on the moon. The universe will be out of balance if you do that. The other thought said, we can't do that. We've got to take care of this earth. We've got to maintain it. We've got to doctor it if it gets sick. We've got to save this earth for children who are coming. And the thought that wanted it all for itself ignored the argument of the other side. The other side didn't like being ignored. So there were two sides instantly, just like Democrats and Republicans. Two sides. Have the side that wanted to use everything up for themselves. And you have the side that wanted to save things for the future. Future children coming. Argument, 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 big argument. The big argument turned to fight, and the fight turned to war. The side that wanted to use up the resources on the first earth used them up, attacking the side that wanted to save the first earth for children coming. But the side that wanted to save the earth used up its half of the earth, repelling the attack from the side that wanted to use up the moon. So the defenders of earth and the offenders of earth wound up using all of the resources on the first earth we call the moon. And in the end, it caught fire, a big fire. Mm-hmm. But so many resources were used up that there wasn't enough water to put the fire out. So the earth, first earth, burned for 1,000,000 years, and it's all burned up today. So he showed us where the war was, where the bombs were, where things were, earth was really defiled in at that time. And it's kind of stupid, all of us sitting here listening to this story, because it sounded like he's predicting that this earth was going to follow the steps of the first earth, which it might, because if you look around, there are two sides. There's one side that wants to use everything for itself, basically the corporate image. Mm-hmm. And there's the side, the common old person around in the streets and sitting at home, that would like to save something. Mm-hmm. And not only are there two sides, one side with an awful lot of bombs and airplanes and ships and missiles, but the other side with an awful lot of determination and a lot of dreams and a lot of power.
A lot of, what did you say, dream?
Did I what?
Did you say dream? A lot of dream and power?
Who dreams?
No, I thought that's what you said.
I said a lot of people have dreams, yes. The one on the side that wants to save the earth is dreaming about saving the earth. The side that's not dreaming about saving the earth is dreaming about cutting down all the trees and drilling holes and dig out some oil and rake out whatever gold's left and retire somewhere fancy. That type of thought, that's a thinking. That the other one is the thinking, two thinkings, the good thinking and the bad thinking. So he was talking about this two sides, and look around at my homeland. A while ago I said it was so beautiful. It still is. But the forests are all cut down. And barbed wire fences, about 300,000 of them a mile. Jackrabbit can hardly get through the barbed wire fences. They're all around, everywhere. And every inch is private property.
Ownership,
And you either keep off, or you get run off, or you get shot at today. So they're very, they guard their evil intent with a rifle. Another thing, just 1 second, everybody, I wanted to tell you one other thing. At Four Corners, a long time ago, in the 60s, we had a confrontation with the federal government, and they came to Four Corners to evict us because they said we were trespassing and we wouldn't go. So they brought their machine guns and shotguns, and they were even deputizing people on the side of the road, so they'd give them a gun and come get us. Anyhow, one of the old chiefs was looking at the sheriff with a machine gun, and he walked over there and he pointed his finger right in his face and he said, "You know, because I know, you know. You know, if you were right, you would not need a gun." And I thought, oh no, I'm going to get shot today for sure. I wonder how it's going to feel. I wonder how long it's going to hurt. Maybe it'll be quick. I was really ready to,
got the truth,
to get shot. But it was really true. And if you look around at these two different sides, you see one side is absolutely geared up to attack everybody else, and they have all of the equipment to do that, from tanks to A-bombs. So we got to be careful about that, but we're getting closer and closer to that time when the two sides are getting very tired of listening to the propaganda of the other side, and we get into a conflict. It seems like we're inviting something terrible to happen to Earth. So I asked an old wise man, well, if the two sides formulate and start at each other, and this is going to turn out like First Earth. And he said, maybe pretty soon, maybe two moon, no Earth. That's where the title of the book came from. And the book explains exactly what I just explained, but a lot longer and better detail. And not only that, it also tells where the power is that is going to change the situation. And that power is all around us right now. Most of us call them children. Extremely powerful little things as far as the universe is concerned, according to legend. They're, according to legend, the Earth is getting to be in a very pitiful condition, which it is right now. So said, okay, here's what has to happen so the earth will be healed and there won't be a two moon. The children, not young adults, children, the children must go out at dawn and sing Yija, the song Yija. Yija is a medicine song. Go out to the dawn and sing Yija to the universe. The universe is waiting for their song. The universe is really waiting for that innocent song, sweet innocent song, to come to it from the children.
The hearts of innocence.
At that time, the earth will be healed. At that time, the ugliness, the badness, will be confronted by the song of the children.
It's true.
And they're going away. And they're not coming back. And there will be spring again. And there'll be fresh water again. And there'll be a lot of things again that some of us have not seen in our lifetime.
You
fresh water, for one.
I know.
So, that's... How to save the earth is to take the children out. The song, somebody says, oh, what's the song? Where's the words? The song has nothing to do with words. Everybody, absolutely everybody, is born with that song in their heart. Over time, the song gets eroded and rusty and thrown away. That's why children have to sing. The song is in their heart, written in their heart. It's just like a bird. A bird wants to sing in the morning. It sings. It doesn't need a word like Star Spangled Banner. So that's what the children... In our lifetime, maybe they'll sing Egypt, and it would be awfully sweet for a lot of us if that happened in our lifetime. I don't have too much more to go.
I want you
but
to
it would
tell
be nice.
Us. Well, yeah. And most people have no idea that that's what's involved. It's that simple. Not so simple, but it takes the power of the innocent heart to confront that other darker force at dawn. And you have a blogging page now. Hayditsula, Greg, how do you...
It's HayditsulaHayditsula.com. And... Yeah, you can sign up, and when Daryl writes...
And he writes eloquently on there. He doesn't like it when I use the word eloquent.
Well, every once in a while, like recently I spoke at a conference down in Southern California, archaeology conference, and I told him I was going to speak at the conference. And I figured I'd get some, a few words of wisdom, an email. And what he wound up, I think he wrote about four papers. About one of them was about six pages or something. He just wrote all kinds of stuff. And I said, you got to put this on your blog. And some of them did wind up in his blog. So
there's so much.
So he goes in spurts. But there is a lot of information on there. There's a lot of wisdom on there.
That you won't hear anywhere else.
You won't hear it anywhere else. Believe me.
And it goes... deep and far.
Yeah,
it is applicable to your life.
Certainly, as far as indigenous wisdom, certainly in California. Not that I know everybody, but I've been around for a while, and certainly Daryl is one of the wisest of our elders, most respected of our elders, because he reaches back to the old wisdom.
Yep,
to
and
the
he
old
still is
old
in
ways.
Touch with it.
Yes,
they send him thought.
Yeah, And Daryl talks about his elders actually sent him out into the world to learn the new world ways, but not to absorb them and use them, just to learn them.
I think you said the enemy. So,
yes, they said learn their ways that they use like bullets, I think is what you said.
He did. I heard that too.
Long before I... Well, matter of fact, I didn't graduate from high school, which took me two more years after I got out of high school to graduate because I didn't have enough credits. I had plenty of credits, but they weren't good credits.
I know, and but to use words, and your bullets were words.
So,
and he...
So the... But I was kind of like one of the more... more educated, kind of in a tribe. I didn't go to high school. Most everybody else goes to jail.
And you got a PhD. You got your doctorate. Went on to teach literature and then Native American literature.
So the old council sent for me, like Craven sent for us with the thought. The thought got by somebody, and somebody said, "Go see."
Darryl.
The council. Oh. And I thought, oh no, the council scattered over 100 miles at home. How am I going to see them, go see them? So I went to the old chief's house. They were all in there. So we had a little talk, but in the course of the talk, the old tribal council was talking about how we get attorneys on our side and teach them and teach them and teach them all the things that they're supposed to know to defend us. And then some corporation comes by and buys our little attorney, and so he's in court testifying against us because he knows exactly what it is we were trying to establish in the court of law, so he could argue that away quick.
Darryl, we're going to have to end now.
So this really has happened to the tribe up to that time a dozen times. They're just putting all your guts and your dreams and everything into an attorney to hope hope you get to court and establish something. But they get bought off. So the council decided that I should go to college. Maybe this kind of thing, we could do something better than get completely railroaded.
Lose everything.
So it took me a few years because I was really scared. How am I going to go to college? I didn't graduate from high school yet. Kind of frightening. But then a couple of years I did. I graduated and went into university. But at that point, the old people said, you must go to college to learn how to use words like bullets, because that's the way America uses their words against us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you, Darryl. This hour went by way too fast. I wish that we were outside sitting around the fire right now and we could just go on till midnight, till the sun rose, the moon, the other way.
Should be on top of Manchester.
Oh, we will be soon. Yeah, I know.
Might be a little cold.
That's later. Soon, summer, the next season. But we've been listening to Darryl Wilson, and he is a renowned author, storyteller, and Native American elder of true wisdom. And he has a website. Greg, could you please?
Sure. www.heydutsila.com. That's his blog. And
don't be surprised if somebody doesn't try to sell you a truckload of hay. They tried it to me.
Oh dear. And he will, and if you email him there, the email address is there, he will email back to you. He loves to respond. Mm-hmm. He loves deep minds. It's been an honor having you here. I really want to have you back on again. If we can arrange it with Greg or
someone. Sure. He took time off from work.
Well, this was a hard gig for me being the co-host, so, but my biggest job was getting him to the microphone. I can do that.
He's in a wheelchair now. It's a lot of work. Thank you, Greg.
My pleasure. My honor.
Yeah, and it's my honor having you on. And now we have, I believe it's Palestinian news, and then free speech news, and then Informativo.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org.